to do yourself. They ought to go back to this car hire company to see if they had done wrong. Clearly they have. They've given you a car that was dangerous, it wasn't fit for purpose, and so on. So they ought to be able to probably counterclaim against that company. Let them do the running around and legwork first. Hopefully you'll get a payout and that'll work. If it doesn't, give me a call back. Next time at the start of the show, so I've got more time to ask you questions and go over it. But again, the first step is definitely the insurance company. Don't do anything else yet. Let them do their job, because hopefully they'll get it sorted for you. Thank you very much for your calls, texts and tweets this evening. That's it from me, consumer lawyer Dean Dunham. A quick reminder that the advice offered in this hour is for guidance only. You should always seek your own independent legal opinion. I'm away next weekend, but I will be back on Sunday, the 14th of December, 9 p.m. with another LBC Consumer Hour. In the meantime, if you missed any of tonight's show, you can listen back on our free Global Player app or the new LBC app, where you can stay up to date with all the latest news and opinion, put your news categories in the order you want, pause and rewind live radio, and listen to a range of podcasts. Download the all-new official LBC app for free from your app store now. Coming up at 1 on LBC, it's James Hansen, but next it's time for Nick Abbott.
Thank you, Dean. A packed programme tonight. We will cover the birth of your party, as they are clunkingly called. Christmas is rushing towards us. We'll talk about the stresses of the season and how to avoid them. Venezuela is under attack from Donald Trump. We'll hear about the inconsistencies in Trump's anti-drugs message. We'll hear the latest on the Ukraine talks to end the war there, and check in with our US correspondent for the latest from America. But first, that budget and what Rachel Reeves was told by the Office for Budget Responsibility before she delivered it. That and more with me, Nick Abbott, after the new news at 10 on LBC.
On your radio, on the LBC app, and
play LBC.
Leading Britain's conversation, this is LBC.
From Global's newsroom, President Trump's Secretary of State has been describing today's talks with Ukraine in Florida as productive and successful. They've included more discussions about steps to end the conflict with Russia. Following last week's meetings in Geneva, Marco Rubio thinks today's developments have been encouraging.
We continue to be realistic about how difficult this is, but optimistic, particularly given the fact that as we've made progress, I think there is a shared vision here that this is not just about ending the war, which is very important. It is about securing Ukraine's future.
The Chancellor has denied misleading the public about the country's finances ahead of the budget. Rachel Reeves has been accused of downplaying the state of the economy so she could raise taxes. That's after a letter from the Office for Budget Responsibility came to light. The US military says 15 sites containing arms dumps held by so-called Islamic State have been destroyed in the south of Syria. US Central Command has announced it's been working with the country's forces during November. The co-founder of your party, Zara Sultana, has been apologizing for hiccups during its foundation. She's told its first conference in Liverpool some of the problems were her fault, but members had to get better at working together. The left-wing writer and activist Michael Chessman has been telling LBC people are looking for a political alternative and it will have to do better.
The whole of your party has been a bit of a mess. But I think it is very easy for the mainstream media and for lots of other politicians to start crowing about what's going on in your party. It's been a deeply unedifying spectacle.
Police Scotland is being urged to reopen an investigation into the former Harrods owner, Mohammed Al-Fayed. More than 400 allegations of sexual misconduct have been made against him, dating back to 1977. He died in 2023. And the death has been announced of the broadcaster Brian Hayes. He was a leading figure at LBC over three decades and is largely credited with pioneering the radio phone-in. And he was doing it on LBC in 1976, following the first commercial flight of Concorde.
In the next hour, we want to hear from you. We want to know what you think of Concorde and how you react to the discussion you've heard on the programme today. 353-8111.
The LBC broadcaster Brian Hayes, who's died at the age of 87. LBC weather clear and frosty in eastern areas at times before milder weather pushes in. That will bring wet and windy conditions from the west. We'll see a low of around 6 degrees. From Global's newsroom, for LBC, I'm Tim Daly.
This is LBC from Global, leading Britain's conversation with Nick Abbott.
Yes, we'll be talking about Brian Hayes shortly. We'll also be talking about your party and what is happening in Venezuela. We'll be discussing the Ukraine developments on the war there and plenty else besides. But let's start with the budget. The budget was probably more talked about than any budget in history, even before it had been delivered. And they're still talking about it now, principally because of the Office for Budget Responsibility. Rachel Reeves has denied lying to the public in the build-up to last week's budget, insisting that she needed to raise taxes to ensure economic stability. The Chancellor said that she had announced £26 billion worth of tax rises on Wednesday, in part to build a buffer against her fiscal rules and reduce the risk of further tax increases in the future, and in part to protect public spending. Let's talk about this with Jasmine Birtles. Jasmine is a personal finance expert and founder of MoneyMagpie.com and joins us on the line now. Hello, Jasmine.
Hello there.
Thanks so much for your time. The OBR first said that the outlook was gloomy and downgraded its expectations for growth. Then it said it got it wrong, but still maintained that expectations for growth were gloomy. I mean, they seem to be all over the place. How can any chancellor base decisions on what they say?
Well, it's a good point, but then apparently we found, according to the OBR, that they sent a note in September saying, oh, actually, it's not that bad. And in fact, well, they didn't actually say, but they implied that she wouldn't need to raise huge amounts of taxes because actually their forecast is much better than expected. And we never heard this. This is not something that the taxpayer was privy to in any way. In fact, she just continued to say, oh, there's a huge black hole, oh, it's terrible. She said it on ITV News in September. She said it on the Financial Times in October. She said it on Breakfast News in November, and we had that briefing, unusual briefing, where she was like, oh, it's going to be poor, it's going to be tough, it's going to be difficult. And I certainly expected horrendous things for the budget. It wasn't nearly as bad as I expected. But it was still far worse than it needed to be. We didn't need to raise $30 billion in taxes. This was, it seems, just a device that she could use to raise lots of taxes to keep her economically illiterate backbenchers happy.
Well, that's one way of putting it. The amount that the OBR eventually came up with was £4 billion. We are £4 billion in the black, they said. That is 0.38% of government spending. It's akin to nothing at all. Wouldn't a responsible chancellor looking to mend a country broken by 14 years of Tory austerity and cuts, should they not ignore that tiny amount and provide for the funds needed to repair the things that we all rely on?
Well, yes, very good point. And this is, you know, part of my complaint is what she's going to spend this extra money on. Certainly some is for infrastructure, because if a government is serious about growing the economy and really building up a country, and we need that, then they would particularly help infrastructure building, you know, all around the country. They would put a lot of money into that. They would also, frankly, in my view, cut taxes, particularly for business. They'd reverse what they did last year, which was very harmful for business, and cut taxes for individuals to give people an incentive to work, to set up businesses, to produce. That's what I would expect to see. But what we've seen, actually, is extra spending on welfare, essentially encouraging people to have more children, encouraging people to not work, really, and to continue doing what we are seeing people doing, which is stopping working in order to get benefits, because in many cases they really are getting better money on benefits than they would in many jobs. And this is not helpful. I don't blame them. You know, if that is the case, why wouldn't you stop and take the money from the government?
There's two arguments there, though. Yeah, forgive me. There's two arguments there, though, isn't it? I mean, if it is true that somebody can, on benefits, get more money than they could if they were working a minimum wage job, then that is less an argument to reduce the benefits and more an argument to increase the amount of the minimum wage. But any suggestion to do that is greeted with howls.
Yes, yes. Well, this is an interesting one because, yes, I am a business. I have a business, as you know. I employ people. And I'm maybe quite unusual in the fact that I agree. This is something that I think should happen because work should pay. We should be able to keep going and have run a family on basic jobs. And certainly that used to be the case. So I do think that we should have a higher minimum wage. And of course, you know, again, this is a contentious issue, but there's an argument to say that we should stop all immigration, legal and illegal, because the main point of immigration is bringing wages down, and particularly in the lower levels. That's always been the case. If you bring lots more people in, then wages are going to go down because there's more competition for the jobs. So these things...
I'm not sure there's much evidence to that. One of the reasons for bringing people into the country is because we're not producing enough young people mm-hmm. ourselves, and that was addressed by the raising of the two-child benefit cap. So you could say this is just encouraging people to have more children, but that is precisely what this country needs, is it not?
Yeah, that is a very good point, yes. So, again, I was thinking this the same, on the one hand, I was thinking this is irresponsible because it's encouraging all sorts of people to have children when they can't afford it. But as you say, we do need to encourage families to have more children because, as you're quite right, that we're not producing enough. And that is one of the reasons why we're having this sort of replacement migration. And it's happening across Europe. But I don't know that it's going to work because, again, just helping with these sort of welfare payments will help somewhat, but it's still expensive just to have children generally. So even without even with the welfare benefits, I'm not sure that a lot of people will be going for extra babies. I hope so, because we need it. We definitely do need much bigger families and much more people having children in this country and across Europe.
Mm. Mm. Do you think that the argument about benefits has been hijacked by people who are trying to suggest that a life on benefits is a life of Riley? People are putting their feet up and smoking a cigar and watching daytime TV all day and counting the loot as it pours into their bank accounts. But that's hardly true. Most of the benefits bill, of course, goes on the state pension, for a start. And there's absolute outrage at any time anybody suggests even looking at dropping the triple lock on that. And a life on benefits is not a life of luxury at all, is it? And so it's a difficult thing to reduce the bill of, because anything that any chancellor of any stripe suggests in that regard it comes up with some large portion of the country is objecting to it. You know, the two-child cap and the suggestion that the winter fuel allowance was going to be dropped. I mean, that was met with outrage and all of these things. So a chancellor is sort of boxed in, really. It's a pretty unenviable task to be a chancellor about to deliver a budget.
I agree, yes. And you're absolutely right about the state pension, et cetera. I mean, currently we spend £124 billion a year on the state pension. And with the triple lock, it's going to just keep going up, even though we're increasing the age at which people can retire and take the state pension. And again, it's something that we're seeing across the West. Particularly, Japan is a particularly good example of it, where they are totally top-heavy with the older generation. And as you say, any time any government tries to cut that, there are, as you say, howls of rage. In France, they just don't suddenly have a government. You know, the government absolutely collapses on that. And that's one of the elements, that's the main reason why they keep collapsing, because they keep trying to make little cuts and the people won't have it. But at some point, we are going to have to make these cuts. And my feeling is that the West is in gradual decline, and there is going to be a point when there is some sort of crash. One of the countries will fall over. Maybe it's France, maybe it's Japan. Japan is facing quite a lot of difficulties at the moment. Maybe it's the UK, maybe it's America. And then others will fall after that. And then once we have a crash and everybody realizes there really is no money to spend, then I think whoever's in power will be able to say, right, look, seriously, there is no money. We're going to have to make cuts. And that's going to be quite tough, I think, when that happens, because we should be making the cuts now. But as you say, nobody will allow it, particularly the voters.
But there's not much fat on the bone. After 14 years of Tory cuts, well, there can't be very much left to cut that is not going to impact a lot of people's lives negatively. Mm. The opposite of that. There is another choice to cut, of course, and that is to pay more tax. And there is this narrative that we are, you know, particularly put upon in this country as far as personal taxation is concerned. But we just aren't. The OECD, the list of countries in the developed world, of 38 countries, there are only 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, 6 who pay less tax than we do. We are right at the bottom. All of the other countries pay more tax than we do, and it's particularly concentrated at the top, with those countries that, coincidentally, always top the World Happiness Index. Their citizens pay more in tax, but the government then provides the things that those citizens rely on. It's a safety net, and that is why they feel, not happy, it's probably not the right word, but they feel safe and content. Is that not what we would benefit from in this country, to actually swallow the pill, pay more in tax, and receive more throughout our lives because of it?
Yes, I mean, in many cases, particularly in the northern countries, people pay a lot of tax, but they do get a lot back. We don't get very much back, it seems, and I'm not sure why. There's something that we do wrong, where the tax that we do pay is not producing the sort of response that we would like.
It used to, though, didn't it? Before, I mean, I'll just say it out loud. Before the Tories took over, 15 years ago, it used to pay us more. An appointment with the GP was not as rare as hen's teeth. You could pretty much get an appointment the next day.
Well, I don't know. When you say when the Tories got in, I mean, they've been in at different times. Do you mean when? But what about when Mrs. Thatcher was around?
Well,
was it? Yeah, I mean, that, there was that. Then we had, before that, there was Labour, and you'll remember things were very tough. I mean, this is what we're looking at the moment: a new 1970s, where you've got high tax, increasing taxation, and decreasing services. So I think that's, to be honest, that's what I'm hearing, and that's what I'm feeling more, that we're in at the moment. It's more coming up to the 1970s rather than the 2000s.
Right. Well, we can't have another Thatcher because she sold everything. There's nothing left. Let's just talk about the effect of the budget. If people feel that, particularly around this time of year, there's people are impelled to go out and start throwing money around that they don't have. You are an advisor on this sort of thing. What would you advise people to do?
Well, it's the same as I say every year, actually, which is really don't spend too much on Christmas, and certainly don't get yourself into debt, because January is a tough month anyway. It's a long month, about 5-week month. It's cold, it's dark, the credit card bills come in, and it's just not, it's not worth it if you can manage somehow to cut things down. Now, there are various ways to do it. And I think that nowadays, because so many people are struggling, even people on sort of medium or higher incomes, they feel like they're struggling. They feel poorer because the price of food has gone up so much. Because of that, I think it's much easier now to say to friends and family, look, we're not doing a big Christmas this year, so should we just agree not to give each other presents, or we'll just have a cap on presents, this sort of thing. I think it's easier to be open about it now and just not embarrassed about saying we're cutting back, and we're, you can couch it in terms of we don't like the commercialism of Christmas. Everyone nods sagely when you say that, that sort of thing. There are lots of good excuses around now. But with quite a lot of people, just being open about it, I think, is a good one. And just deciding, right, we're going to have a nice Christmas, but we're not going to get ourselves into stupid debt for it, because it's just not worth it.
Jasmine, very good to talk to you. Thanks so much for your time. Jasmine Birtles, personal finance expert and founder of MoneyMagpie.com. So I know that there's been a lot of air expelled about the budget, both before and afterwards. But what do you make of this new line of attack that the Chancellor actually kept secret advice from the Office for Budget Responsibility that things weren't quite as bad as they are? I mean, there's no suggestion that she's actually putting the money in her pocket or giving it to donors and mates, as previous governments seem to have managed to get away with. But she's taking more money from us to supposedly make things better in the short and the medium term. So what do you make of that? And what do you make of this row about the Office for Budget Responsibility? And do you think that rather than complain that we are very, very highly taxed, the truth is that actually compared to most of the countries that we compete with, that we sit alongside with in the in, you know, what used to be called the first world, we are taxed quite low. It might seem counterintuitive because that's not the message you get from the press, but the facts are suggest that that is the case. So, 0345 6060 973. You can text 84850, email nick@lbc.co.uk. And if you're on WhatsApp, it's the same number as the phone. 0345 6060 973. Friday, Saturday, Sunday night at 10. Nick Abbott, LBC.
This is LBC.
For people living with dementia, Christmas can be confusing, overwhelming, heartbreaking. Families are often left to cope alone. But you can help a family reimagine Christmas. Donate to Alzheimer's Society and you can help provide practical support, expert advice and crucial companionship this Christmas. It will take a society to beat dementia and we can't do it without you. Search Alzheimer's Society and donate today.
Do you know your state pension age? No. Maybe you're not sure or you don't know how to check. It's so quick and easy to check online. All you need is your date of birth. Knowing your state pension age helps you think about your future. So check yours today. Search state pension age on gov.uk and simply enter your date of birth. State pension age. It's good to know.
This is LBC with Nick Abbott. Call 0345 6060 973. Text 84850. Alexa, send a comment to LBC.
Taking your thoughts about the budget, now the dust has settled on the it of it, how do you feel about how your finances are going to be affected or not? And also what you think about this rage about the Office for Budget Responsibility and didn't they tell Rachel Reeves that she could or couldn't have confidence that there was some sort of buffer in her spending plans? 0345 6060 973. Also, as you heard in the news, the death has been announced of the broadcaster Brian Hayes at the age of 87. He was a leading figure at LBC over three decades and is largely credited with pioneering the concept of the radio phone-in in this country. With a career spanning more than five decades, Hayes began his radio life as a newsreader for a radio station in Kalgoorlie in Perth. He then moved to Britain, joining Capital Radio as a producer at its launch in 1973, and then later joined the on-air crew at LBC in 1976. And Brian Hayes came to define the sound of LBC in the 1970s and 1980s. If you would like to share your memories of Brian Hayes, then the number is the same, 0345 6060973. Hackney. Hello, Gabriel.
Hey, Nick. How are you doing?
Good, thanks.
Yeah, it's a very good point you make about the OECD list, because it's a shame that we see in the UK a taxation as a burden or a negative thing when it's actually a good patriotic thing to pay into. You know, you look at the Scandinavian model where they reap the rewards of their high taxes with better public services and a happier way of living.
Yes, burden is one of those phrases that is used. The tax take is another, as though we don't actually get anything for it. But all of the things that we rely on, you know, the obvious ones.
The army and, yeah.
Yeah, our defence, the NHS, you know, the upkeep of everything that you don't really think about much until it goes wrong in life. That all comes from taxation. Now, we either take the American model, where it's, you know, every man for himself, and, you know, if you're rich, then you're fine, and if you're not, then you probably won't be. If, you know, a small piece of bad luck will have you out in the streets. And then, if that's what people actually want, and I suspect that people who do want that feel that, you know, nothing negative or bad will ever happen to them, and the best of luck with that. Or we could spend more initially, pool our resources, and go with the happy people, because there's no question the World Happiness Index is an indicator of how, if not, you know, not people walking around with a smile on their face, but they just feel safe and content. Now, would that not be a thing to aspire to feel safe and content?
Oh, that's absolutely right. And, you know, in this country, we want that model. We're just not willing to
pay for
kind
it.
Of contribute to it.
Yes.
I mean, the good point that you made there about, you know, if, like the two-child benefit cap, you know, that's a progressive policy to scrap it. In fact, it was a policy the Tories brought in anyway, so it was always a thing not to have it. I think people have kind of forgotten that. But it's, you know, if people fall into bad luck, that policy is there to help you and protect you. Exactly how taxation should be spent on, you know, helping out the people with less and for general society.
Yes, and I feel that people do complain about it because they don't think that they're ever going to be one of the people that need the help of the state. But it's like you're paying for the fire brigade. You only want to pay for the fire brigade when your house is actually on fire. Well, it don't work like that.
What is it? What is it? 10 million people in the UK have less than £100 in savings at the end of the month? You know, see, how close are people to, you know, a couple of paychecks lost to needing that two-child benefit, like the benefit payment or any other benefit payment?
Yeah,
but
exactly.
Yeah, thank you, Nick.
All right, thanks, Gabriel. 0345 6060 973. Dan Needle at Tax Policy Associates looked at this. He said, we can use the OECD's most recent data to chart the tax wedge for every country in the OECD, the developed world. He says, looking at the average wage of a single worker, a single earner family with two children, and a dual earner family with two children, the result is striking. The UK has one of the lowest tax wedges in the OECD for single workers and dual earner families, and a lower than average tax wedge for single earner families. He says the simple story is that at all points, French, Italian, Scandinavian, Spanish, etc. workers pay around 50% more tax on their wages than a comparable earner in the UK. He said most people in the UK on low, moderate or reasonably high earnings, that is up to about £100,000 a year, pay less tax on their wages than their counterparts in other large developed countries, with the notable exception of the US. And in the US, of course, if you get sick, then you start paying immediately. And there was a story in the papers the other day of somebody who needed an ambulance and was charged £9,000 for the transport to the hospital. Now, if that's what you want to risk, well, then we can go the American way. He said, 2024 set a post-war record. The average UK worker paid less wage tax than at any time since the 1940s. 2024. He said 2025, and he is including the budget, nudged upwards back to roughly 1990s levels, which were already the lowest in the modern era. We're being pummeled by the illusion that we're being that we are suffering under this horrendous amount of tax that we have to pay. But compared to most other civilized countries in the world, we just don't. I mean, I could give you a list of all of the countries in the OECD that pay more tax on their wages than we do. Costa Rica, Australia, the United States, Iceland, Canada, Japan, Poland, the Netherlands, Ireland, Denmark, Norway, Turkey, Greece, Lithuania, Portugal, Luxembourg, Estonia, Spain, Czechia, Hungary, Sweden, Latvia, Finland, Slovak Republic, Slovenia, Austria, Italy, France, Germany and Belgium. All pay more taxes on their wages than we do.
It's as though we've been hypnotized into believing that what is up is actually down. And it does come down to taxes don't just go up in smoke, as Dan Needle said. It's obvious. Countries with higher taxes will have mostly better funded welfare systems and public services. Now, do we want to be more like the US, where they don't have that and there is no safety net? Well, and it's every man for himself, and those that have made it are fine, and those that haven't are sort of teetering on the edge of disaster. Or do we want to be more like Denmark, where the happy people live? 0345-6060-973. I'm going to take a break for the news. Coming up, more of your calls on this, and how do we tackle the spiralling housing costs for young people? We'll hear from an expert who may have a solution. 10:30 on LBC, the news headlines with Tim Daly.
President Trump's Secretary of State's been describing today's talks with Ukraine in Florida as productive and successful. They've included more discussions about steps to end the conflict with Russia following last week's meetings in Geneva. Downing Street says the Prime Minister is to set out how last week's budget will push forward the government's programme of national renewal. Sir Keir Starmer is due to give a speech tomorrow following widespread criticism of Rachel Reeves' measures. And police in Northern California say three of the four people who died following a mass shooting there were children. They were at a birthday party in the city of Stockton, around 60 miles from San Francisco. LBC weather, clear and frosty for eastern parts of the country for a while before milder weather arrives. That will bring wet and windy conditions. We'll see a low of around 6 degrees.
This is LBC.
When you buy a BMW approved used electric car, there are no surprises. You'll find the largest range and the widest choice. Naturally, every car has been meticulously checked by qualified BMW technicians. Hardly a plot twist. And they always come with a battery health report and at least 12 months unlimited mileage BMW warranty. Just as you'd expect. BMW approved used electric cars. Nothing new here. Search BMW approved used electric. Obviously.
Hi, I'm looking for a pair of jeans.
Right. Low slung, slouchy, wide leg, bower leg, curved leg, flared, straight or skinny?
Blue?
Fashion. It's hard to keep on top of. Other things like the upcoming changes to renting are a bit easier. As a landlord, you will need to get on top of these important changes. These changes will affect how you manage your tenancies. Read the guidance at gov.uk/renting-is-changing.
When it comes to retirement advice, the last thing you want is to be put in a bucket. Seen as this type of person, or that type of person. At Fisher Investments UK, we never put you in a bucket. We always tailor retirement advice that's just right for you. Fisher Investments UK, retirement advice that's as individual as you are. Learn more at fisherinvestments.co.uk. Investing involves the risk of loss. Fisher Investments UK is regulated by the UK Financial Conduct Authority.
Nick Abbott on LBC. Call 0345 6060 973.
More of your thoughts on Rachel Reeves, the OBR, and whether taxation in this country is actually as bad as people in the, particularly the right-wing press, that want to bring the government down, whether they are actually right in saying that we are particularly put upon in this country, because the figures suggest otherwise. That's to come. But first, Polly Hudson wrote a piece in the I paper today comparing her ease climbing the property ladder compared with her son. And while it's nothing new that property is more expensive than it used to be, what is new are figures from the ONS detailing how young people are leaving the UK in larger numbers than they used to. Shiv Malik is an author and journalist and co-founder of Forest City One Renewable City Project, and he thinks he may have an answer to the escalating cost of living for Britain's youth. And he joins us on the line now. Hello, Shiv.
Hello, good evening.
Very good of you to join us. So you have an answer. What is it?
Yes, of a sort. I mean, I've been on this train warning about the kind of impending or kind of arrived housing crisis for about 15 years now, after writing that book, Jilted Generation, some time ago. And the solution that we're putting forward and what we've proposed is to build Britain's first city in over 50 years. It's to the east of Cambridge. It's over 45,000 acres, and it'll have 400,000 homes. And the great thing about it is because it's a city – It has not just homes, but also commercial land. The commercial land pays for the infrastructure. The homes are basically net revenue neutral, and they're sold at cost, which means you could get a four-bedroom house for about £350,000, which is a lot cheaper than certainly in London and even certainly in Cambridge.
There's, you know, a lot of developers who throw up these hideous developments of, you know, bright red, ugly, furious-looking buildings, and they just stand there sort of moored in the middle of nowhere with the infrastructure that you were just describing notably absent. How are you going to get them to actually spend money on putting that stuff up?
Well, this is the thing. I spent a long time listening to people who objected to housing because I wanted to know why housing wasn't being built for my generation. I'm now 44, so I'm not young anymore. But pretty much, you know, most of my friends have left the country, as those statistics reveal. You know, they've gone off to America or Norway or Germany, et cetera, et cetera. And it's been, and, you know, it's really sad. It's really sad to watch your friendship group and your family just depart, and you know that your kids will never grow up together, etc. So I spent a long time listening to, you know, people who would otherwise be labeled as NIMBYs and try to figure out, you know, hey, what's going on here? Why do you object to housing? And one of those things is what you said. They just look terrible, but they also don't come with the infrastructure. So they kind of, you know, try and squash them in on the edge of towns. And, you know, there's not enough road space, there's not enough GPs, and there's enough anything really after that. And the other thing is that they tend not to be affordable at all. So when they are built, they're still at market rates. So it doesn't seem to help anything. So this is why we're doing it differently. We're saying, look, let's do all of that placemaking, as it's known, right? Let's put the hospitals and the doctor surgeries and the roads and the trains. Let's do it in one place so it comes together. And then let's have the government set up a development corporation, which is the same tool we use to build the Olympics, Milton Keynes, Canary Wharf. And so we can do this at speed, at pace, but also so it's rational, right? All in one place, thought out, master plan, and it will look beautiful.
Okay. Now, if it's just to the east of Cambridge, I would imagine at least one blade of grass exists in the site that you have your mind set on. Now, there are you've mentioned NIMBYs. Very suggestion that somebody is going to build on even a single blade of grass gets people apoplectic. How are you going to get past that?
Yeah, it's a good point. I think people have realized, again, over the last couple of decades, look, monocultural farmland isn't exactly the best thing for nature, right? We've kind of been almost greenwashed into thinking that, you know, crops, you know, sort of cereals and crops that are sort of grown are, you know, the field might look green, but it's actually just industrial land, right? It doesn't actually do anything for nature. In fact, it's one of the reasons why we're the most nature depleted countries on the planet, as we're often told, right? So what we want to do is, I mean, even urban gardens are a lot better for nature than your monocultural fields. Now, of course, they come with hedgerows and there's some trees, but actually most of this land is pretty bad for nature. So what we want to do is also plant a 12,000 acre forest. We think we can do that alongside then obviously the urban development, but more than that, we've just learned so much more over the last 50 years of how to do this stuff properly, how to actually build in harmony with nature. I don't want to live in a nature eradicated place, do I? So, you know, and this will be, if this city goes ahead, I'll definitely be living there. So, you know, that's, we know how to do this a lot better than we have. It's just that we haven't had the chance to build anywhere properly in one place and at scale.
It's a lovely location, nice part of the country. It would be pleasant to live there. But how are you going to get developers, who presumably will be involved with this, to build anything other than those identikit, hideous houselets that are cropping up all over the country like a disease?
Well, it's because we're not using developers. That's why. The developer is the master builder, and that'll be the development corporation. So it's the government, in effect, that we're petitioning to say, look, why don't you just compulsory purchase the land? And, you know we can build beautifully in this country. We've been doing it for, you know, hundreds of years. You know, you look at sort of Georgian or Victorian homes, people love them. We know we can do this a lot better, right? And even, you know, the king has tried himself with power. Townbury, it looks pretty great. It's got some problems. And obviously, it's not at scale. It's only, I think, 4,000 homes all in all. But we can absolutely do it. The problem with the current mode of why developers build in the way that they do is because it takes them years to get planning permission, and that's where all the costs go. So the houses in the end look terrible because they're trying to save money. So this scheme is to say, let's not have developers. Let's just have one developer, the government, in effect, right? And on top of that, then we'll get the house builders to just be house builders, but we'll tell them what to build. So that's the big difference.
And what confidence do you have that the government will actually receive this positively?
Well, we've got a lot of work to do. So far, we've had more than 1,000 people sign our petition, which is a great start. Some really, really impressive names on there. Whether it's the, you know, principal architect at Zaha Hadid, some brilliant economists. We're about to launch or announce our board in the next couple of weeks. People will be pretty shocked at the standard of names and the quality of names that are sort of joining the board. But we've got to win over not just obviously the Secretary of State, Steve Reed, for housing. We've got to win over a lot of people, including, you know, local government, West Suffolk, but also just the people on the ground and the landowners. So we're speaking to everyone. We're moving at pace, to use that civil service term. You know, we've only been at this for 5 weeks, but we've managed to make huge amounts of progress. And we're doing this completely differently. You know, we're effectively a bunch of volunteers who are, you know, engineers, urban designers, ecologists, all volunteering our time because we don't want the housing crisis to go on like it has been for the last 15 years.
Well, if it would lead to developments that are less hideous than what we are suffering at the moment in this country, then I wish you all the very best, Shiv. Thanks so much for your time. That's Shiv Malik, co-founder of Forest City One, a renewable forest city which aims to tackle housing costs and environment issues. And the co-author of Jilted Generation, How Britain Has Bankrupted Its Youth. Now, back to what we were talking about earlier on, which was, I guess it was a range of topics centred around the budget. This, in my mind, confected outrage about the OBR. The Tories are saying that she should have listened to the OBR, but these are, of course, the same Conservatives who used to attack that very organisation. You might remember Jacob Rees-Mogg said the OBR's forecast should not be treated as definitive, and that its forecasts were not enormously good, in his words. And ahead of the Conservative government's March budget of last year, 46 Tory MPs and 4 Tory peers wrote to the then Chancellor, Jeremy Hunt, urging him to ignore the OBR. And the OBR itself wrote a paper outlining its own many miscalculations since 2010, so I think it's a bit rich that those same Tories are now putting such store in what the OBR said. Your thoughts, please. 0345 6060 973. Wood Green. Hello, Saul.
Oh, hello. Can you hear me?
Yes, go ahead.
So here's my thought, right? So it's been mulling over my head for a bit. Everyone talks about the Scandinavian model. Everyone's happy in the Scandinavian model. And, you know, it comes up, it's quite a sort of common thread that you hear. Now, Sweden, Denmark, Finland all have national service. I think it's between 1 to 2 years, compulsory, mandatory. And everyone that goes up and pays their taxes and contributes, in a way, I think to myself, well, if you have a national service, then everyone has to give back on quite a large commitment to the point that there may be war when they are in national service. I mean, there's not war at the moment, but of course, even more at the moment, it's even more prevalent that there might be war. Everyone's mobilising up there. But the idea that, you know, the problem in this country is that you sort of feel that not everyone's giving back. And, you know, there comes a point where the idea of the rich will pay, there's more vulnerable, that's all fine. That's all fine. But you just don't get the sense that everyone's in it together. I was thinking like, you know, if you go back to the idea of, Rishi Sunak was, it was not possible for him to bring in that rule at the time, but the idea of this national service, but it's interesting because I think if everyone did a national service here for a couple of years, I think the idea about higher taxes, it would just level it all out. And I think everyone would feel that we are all contributing regardless of if you're wealthy or poor. You all have to do this national service. And we just don't have that here.
I mean, it could be. I'm not sure what the rules in all of those countries that you mentioned are, but I think it's at least in some of them you don't have to actually do military national service, but you could, if you liked, choose to do some other good for the society.
I mean, I don't know, but it is called national service. Obviously, you know, at some level you contribute on a national level. Mm. Now, I think if we had that in this country, I think people would speak differently.
Well, it's an interesting idea, highly controversial, of course, and I'm sure that to those who are too old to enjoy national service would be more for it, perhaps, than those who might get a letter through the post. But thanks for that, Saul. 0345 6060 973. LBC.
Nick Ferrari at breakfast on LBC.
His numbers add up.
6-7. 6-7. Everyone here, are you doing page 6-7?
But to hers.
Today I will maintain all income tax and equivalent national insurance thresholds at their current level for a further 3 years.
The Chancellor pulls the plug on playtime as she knocks 6-7 bells out of the pay packets of working people. How fair is the welfare budget, and could she come back for more?
Can you assure my listeners now, no more tax increases?
Look, no Chancellor can predict the future or write next year's budget.
Nick Ferrari at breakfast. Back tomorrow morning from 7. Listen on our free Global Player app or the new LBC app.
Angela Rippon, what are you doing here?
I've come to tell you about using energy flexibly, Albert.
Flexibly?
Yes, smart meter owners could get rewarded for moving their energy use, like doing the laundry at off-peak times.
So I don't need to do the splits?
No, Albert, nobody wants to see that.
Get rewarded for using energy flexibly, only with a smart meter. Search Get a Smart Meter today.
Eligibility and availability vary. Consumer action required. Reward schemes and tariffs available to selected customers from selected suppliers.
How's the business going?
We're busier than ever, but struggling to get the staff we need.
Oh, recruiting can be such a distraction. We gave Job Centre Plus a try, and they've really helped us out.
Really?
Yeah, it was dead easy. We got our own employer advisor, Julie, who helped advertise our jobs, shortlisted candidates for us, and let us interview at the Job Centre. We've hired some great people, and Job Centre Plus really took the hassle out of it, and there was no fee.
Brilliant. That's straight on my to-do list.
Find out more at business.gov.uk/recruit. Eligibility criteria apply.
You're already looking at the Galaxy S25 Ultra. Top-tier specs, powered by Galaxy AI with pro-grade camera. And now you can save £250 thanks to our incredible Black Friday event. The upgrade you want and the best deals you probably hadn't expected. But let's not hang around. This deal won't. The Galaxy Black Friday event is on right now. Buy yours at Samsung.com. Purchase from Samsung.com by the 2nd of December.
Nick Abbott on LBC. Call 0345 6060 973.
Some text on this subject. Anne says, "Dear Nick, regarding the budget and black holes, can you explain why they are talking about billions of black holes when we owe trillions?" Well, I don't think they're talking about billions of black holes, but billions of pounds in a black hole. Yes, it's a difference between how much you owe and how much you spend day to day. As compared with how much comes in day to day. In a nutshell. York, hello, Claire.
Hi, Nick, hi. First of all, before I get on to my main point, I just want to say about the OBR, I just think they're all over the place. I mean, how is a Chancellor supposed to put all her eggs into what they say when she can see for herself what the needs of the country is? And it's laughable, really, that we've had the right wing for months saying that Labour have harmed the economy, arguing that everything they've done has been disastrous, and then now to turn around and say, oh, everything is rosy and there's no need for taxes. Both cannot be true.
True, yes.
And yes, I think Labour have made some great strides in 1 year, and made improvement. And you know, the economy has just turned very slightly, but it has turned in a positive direction. But that's not to say that they don't need to take in tax for huge problems in this country, and for anyone to take from the OBR that everything's fine here, no taxes needed, it's just patently absurd.
Yes, I don't think that the OBR said no taxes were needed, but I just think that they corrected their initial misinformation that they released regarding the amount of, in the this awful clunky phrase, fiscal headroom the Chancellor had to work with.
Well, Labour got in on a promise of change, and you can't do that on a shoestring. Right. So I think it's absolutely right that they should maximise what taxes they can take in with the broadest shoulders. And as to your first guest, I couldn't quite catch her thread of argument, because she started off by saying, in her words, all sorts of people would be encouraged to have children because of the cab being lifted. And then later she said that we don't have enough children, but that benefits wouldn't be enough to encourage people to have children. So those two arguments sort of counteracted each other. And just to be clear, it's the majority of people who will be benefited from this cap being lifted are working people on benefit. So and obviously people can be on have large families, not be on benefits, and then suddenly find themselves for the need of that.
That's right.
And if they can bring children out of poverty, that has got to only be a good thing. And to call us in the 1970s tax with poor services, when in 1 year we've had an NHS waiting list come down. We've got planning reform going through at the moment, which will make affordable housing building and projects like your previous guest easier, because they're planning. Labour have announced that they're planning on freeing areas around train stations to build houses, so that there's good infrastructure for people to be able to commute. And things.
The things that the Labour Party have achieved in a relatively short period of time are worth shouting about. It's just that all the shouting is going in the opposite direction.
And it doesn't help when people say that we've got 1970s tax and 1970s poor services,
right,
when demonstrably that is just not true.
Okay. All right, I've got to move on, but thanks, Claire. 0345 6060973. Yeah, all of the shouting is going in the opposite direction from the offshore-owned billionaire press, who are just desperate to get their man in number 10. So it's a bit difficult for the Labour Party to actually put across what it has achieved so far and what is the direction of travel, because all of the messages that the public receive are, you know, oh, woe is us, this is a catastrophe, the whole country is going down, everybody man the lifeboats. It is a problem of communication, and the Labour Party have been not very good at it so far, but, you know, the headwinds are blowing in the other way. Grant says, hi, Nick, no one chooses a life on benefits, trust me. I'm a single man, I live off my £320 per calendar month. My shopping budget is £14 a month. It's not easy at all. Your shopping budget is £14 a month. That can't be right. Shopping budget for what? Anyway, £320 a month, that's the number that we should be concentrating on. It is not a life of Riley. Brighton. Hello, Joe.
Hi, Nick. We've spoken before about Labour's communication.
Oh, yeah.
I mean, we did say get two press secretaries and only come out when you need to come out, because, like you said, the papers will always twist it. And you know what gets me about these people talking about Labour? Why are Labour so bad at reminding people that George Osborne said to Nick Clegg, and it's in Nick Clegg's book, that we won't build social housing because it creates Labour voters? And these people want to put reform in. And what embarrasses me, we've got small countries, which are Saudi Arabia is the 19th largest economy in the world, buying up half of the world. Why don't we take back our oil companies? Take them back. Put an executive order, we're going to buy back our oil companies and turn them into a nation wealth fund. This is just nonsense. We're allowing these oil companies to make money on the back of Margaret Thatcher's mistake.
Well, we should be more like Norway. But to be more like Norway, we'd need to get into a time machine and go back to Margaret Thatcher's time in office and persuade her not to throw away all our best stuff for a short-term profit.
Well, you see, Nick, the problem here, right? Labour hasn't learnt from what me and you've been talking about over the last month about their press operation. And like Nick, James O'Brien said, the Telegraph is no longer read by barons and lords. They don't mean they're nothing. Ignore them. Why is Labour keeping having interviews in the Telegraph?
They do matter. And I think it's important to take your message to the enemy, for want of a better word. There's no point in the Labour Party only
coming to the Mirror.
The Mirror and the Guardian and friendly outlets like that. They have to take the message to where people are getting propaganda. Essentially, is what it is. To try to, get their face in there. Thanks, Joe. 0345-6060-973. Matt in Worcester says, a life on benefits is a life that benefits from benefits, but there is no benefit in having to rely on benefits. The benefits of being a man of independent means eclipses all known state benefits. Let's create a benefit that benefits us all, says Matt in Worcester. Good work, Matt. And Andy in Berlin says, you don't live on benefits, you survive. That's right. Westerham, Michael.
Good evening.
Michael.
Hello there. Well, I'm pretty disgusted with this do child cap being, obviously taken away, because I think all this is going to encourage the lady who sits on a sofa all day watching loose women and they're eating pork pies to go out, get pregnant, have all these kids, as many as possible. And you think when she gets the benefit of the extra child, do you think it's actually going to go to the child? No, they're going to use it on their pork pies or their drugs or whatever.
Oh, right? Michael, I do feel you are desperately trying to be controversial. Go and try it somewhere else. Louise in Putney says, hi, Nick, it is not true that people receive more on benefits than in work. Well, you could fashion an example that might show just that people receive more on benefits than they do in work, but only because work pays so very badly for a lot of people in this country. If you can find people who receive more on benefits than people in work, then that is not a reason to cut their benefits. It is a reason to increase the minimum wage. But, and as I said to my guest earlier on, the moment that anybody suggests an increase in the minimum wage, then the howls of outrage you could hear through concrete. Lauren says, so more pressure on women particularly. Have more children, go back to work, send your baby to nursery and spend thousands a month on nursery school. Mothers should be able to stay at home with their children and take the pressure off trying to do it all. Absolutely. And one of the things that is preventing them from doing that is that we have among the highest childcare costs in the world in this country. There's very few countries that actually charge more for childcare than we do. And one of the ways in which you can provide for better and more accessible childcare is by taking taxation. Now, it might hurt a tiny bit in the short term, but for the benefit of the nation, we would rather prefer that people grew up well-adjusted and healthy, because if they don't, it's going to cost us more in the long term. Lauren says, Matt in Nottingham says, we would be happy with paying more tax if the cost of housing was comparable. We pay more for almost everything here in the UK, leaving little headroom for taxing us more, caused again by professional politicians selling everything off. Genius, says Matt. Well, the attraction of selling things off is great for a politician, because it gets you short-term gain, which is what politicians are always interested in. They don't really care much, or it's not really in their interests to fashion something that might hurt in the short term to benefit us in the long term, because they won't be in place in the long term. Hemel Hempstead. Hello, Jim.
Hello.
Jim.
You good?
Yes, good, thanks.
Yeah, so quick from me is what I find hard is people work very, very, very. The more you work, the more tax you pay, from life to debt. And I just think it's wrong that she has genuinely raised all the taxes by not telling her the truth. I think she needs to go. I understand there's a lot of challenges. I understand, for me, that National Health is super, because anytime I've needed it, it delivers. But I am concerned that a lot of people are working so hard, and we just seem to be paying tax continuously, and it doesn't seem to end.
Well, no, it will never end. That's the nature of tax. It will end at the other inevitability, death. But this idea that we pay more in tax than, we're sort of more put upon than other countries is blown out of the water. If you just actually look at how much tax other countries pay, other countries in the developed world. I mean, you could go to Dubai and pay zero tax, but then you would be living in Dubai with everything that comes from that. Thanks for all your calls on that subject. We're going to change it up after the news. Zara Sultana has hit out at the new left-leaning Your Party, accusing the leadership of a left-wing witch hunt. The barb comes amid a chaotic conference in Liverpool where more problems than policies seem to have arisen. Do you trust the left wing to represent your interests without fighting among themselves? It seems to be their thing. We'll hear from the political editor of The Independent about that very subject. 0345 6060 973. Friday, Saturday, Sunday night at 10. Nick Abbott, LBC.
On your radio, on the LBC app, and
play LBC.
Leading Britain's conversation. This is LBC.
From Global's newsroom at 11 o'clock. President Trump's Secretary of State says today's talks on ending the war in Ukraine have been about securing the country's future. He's been speaking after receiving a delegation from Kyiv in Florida, following last weekend's discussions which took place in Geneva. But Marco Rubio's been telling reporters the Kremlin remains a major consideration.
Obviously, there's another party involved here that'll have to be a part of the equation, and that'll continue later this week when Mr. Witkoff travels to Moscow, although we've also been in touch in varying degrees with the Russian side, but we have a pretty good understanding of their views as well. So much work remains, but today was again a very productive and useful session.
Downing Street says the Prime Minister is to set out how last week's budget will push the government's programme of national renewal. Sir Keir Starmer is due to give a speech tomorrow following widespread criticism of Rachel Reeves' measures and earlier claims of a shortfall in the public finances. Luke Francis is a former Westminster political adviser. He's been telling LBC the government's got itself into a mess.
It was very much a political budget. We knew that there were going to be decisions that had to be taken around taxation and public spending. But what's become clear over the last 24 hours has been that some of those decisions perhaps didn't need to be as difficult as they purported to be.
A man's been arrested on the suspicion of attempted murder after four people were injured in Greater Manchester. Officers were sent to Altrincham following reports of what's being called a disturbance early this morning. The Health Secretary says the government's target to end new HIV transmissions by 2030 is now within reach. Wes Streeting is expected to use tomorrow's World AIDS Day to announce a new action plan. And the LBC broadcaster Brian Hayes has died at the age of 87. He's widely credited with helping to pioneer the radio phone-in in the UK. In January 1976, he was talking to a future Prime Minister here on LBC.
Good morning. If you've just joined us, welcome to our programme. It was once reported that Margaret Thatcher, the Conservative leader of the opposition, said, "In politics, if you want anything said, ask a man. If you want anything done, ask a woman." Margaret Thatcher is our guest this morning on LBC, and you can phone her on this number, 353-8111. Good morning to you, Mrs. Thatcher.
Good morning.
The broadcaster, Brian Hayes, whose death has been announced this evening. LBC weather clear and frosty in eastern parts of the country at times before milder weather pushes in. That will bring with it wet and windy conditions from the west. We'll see a low of around 6 degrees. From Global's newsroom, for LBC, I'm Tim Daly.
This is LBC from Global, leading Britain's conversation with Nick Abbott.
Zara Sultana boycotted the first day of Your Party's inaugural conference, throwing the first official gathering into chaos amid disagreements with co-founder Jeremy Corbyn about quite a good amount. Let's talk about this with David Maddox. David is the political editor of The Independent and joins us on the line now. Hello, David.
Hi there. How are you?
Good, thanks. Typical left fighting among themselves over purity of belief while the right wing storm ahead by sticking to their script. even if it is a tower of lies. Quite predictable, this, isn't it?
I mean, it feels like a kind of tale as old as time, as I say. You know, I mean, it's definitely got that kind of Monty Python feel to it. You know, people's want of Judea and all the rest of it, you know. I mean, it's absolute madness, actually.
They were disagreeing, among other things, about how the party should be run. Jeremy Corbyn thought it should be one individual. He said it was hard for people to grasp that there are sort of 10 people who run things. There's an element of truth in that, isn't it? I mean, a party, especially a new one, needs someone for the public to focus on.
Yeah, it does. I mean, that's really the role of the leader. It's interesting, actually, that the Green Party are probably the main beneficiaries of all this nonsense. It took a long time to learn that and kind of had these multiple leader models. And suddenly are actually seeing huge success with Zach Polanski having decided to go for one charismatic leader and let, you know, other people run things in the background, but just kind of go for it with somebody to sell the message as such.
Yes, I mean, just as an aside, that is quite a remarkable turnaround in the fortunes of the Greens, who were forever the sort of 3 or 4% party, but they seem to have exploded almost overnight.
Well, I mean, the fact is that your party or whatever could have succeeded because it had the basis there. You know, it had Jeremy, it had Zara, you know, it had two reasonably well-known charismatic figures. And there's a huge gulf on the left of politics. You know, this Labour government has completely lost it, I'm afraid, in terms of credibility and all sorts of things. But, you know, it kind of abandoned the left side of politics exactly for this sort of thing. And them messing it up has in enormous wasted opportunity for them. And all they've done actually really is hand it over to the Greens, who got their act together just in the nick of time and are now absolutely capitalising on it.
Yes, what do you think of the vote to not exclude those who are members of other political parties? I'm talking again about I wish it was called something else, but...
No, I know.
It's just dreadful. But your party, I mean, it seems logical, doesn't it? How can you support two competing parties at the same time?
I think it's just part of the enormous dysfunction that's going on there. I mean, the fact is, I couldn't even hold on to two of our MPs, you know, two of these kind of, these Gaza independents, who are not exactly on the sanest footing of political platforms. Even they thought this was a bit too bonkers for them, so, and have walked away. And it's just, you know, clearly they want to kind of appease Zara or whatever, but it's just mad. But, you know, we don't even know who's going to end up as leader of this thing. It may well be that the MPs aren't allowed to be leader of this party either, which is just, I mean, it just gets stranger with each development.
Yeah, on the subject of MPs, I mean, there's a lot of ship jumping going on at the moment, isn't there? Reform seems to be a vessel for Tory rejects or refusenecks. Corbyn and Sultana flip from Labour, all while retaining their seats in Parliament. Mm. What do you make of that? Shouldn't you have to stand down if you suddenly decide to join a party other than the one that the electorate thought you represented when they voted for you?
I think there's a very strong moral argument that you should. And Douglas Carswell, of course, took that position, and when he switched to UKIP, was it UKIP back in the day? He held that by-election in Clacton. I think Mark Reckless followed suit as a result. But, of course, most of them don't do that. Most of them are quite happy to hide behind the rules, take one mandate and just try and turn it into a different one altogether. I mean, you could argue that there's reasons against the expense of a by-election. Not many people turn up, but it does seem to me to be dishonest. I don't know about how you legislate to force that to happen, given the our constitutional position is that you elect individuals, not parties.
Yes. And Corbyn, of course, has been an MP since 1982. And he received more votes than Keir Starmer when Starmer won, and more votes than Ed Miliband before him, and more votes than Gordon Brown before him. You had to go all the way back to Tony Blair's first win in 1997 to see a Labour leader get more votes at a general election than Jeremy Corbyn managed to collect. Do you think a terrified right-wing press has conspired to paint him as a failure?
I'm not sure, actually, he's been painted as a failure. He's been painted as all sorts of different unpleasant things, I mean, including the whole anti-Semitism business. But I'm not sure he was entirely painted as a failure. It's interesting, actually, that that same right-wing press is now kind of comparing him to Keir Starmer and comparing those results and pointing out that Keir Starmer got far less votes. You know, these things are always on slightly shifting ground when it comes to coverage and things. And I think it probably says a lot more about how people now view Starmer than it does how they view Jeremy.
Well, do you think that he still has positive feelings among at least the members of the public that would be, you know, putatively on his side, to the extent that, absent these initial teething problems that your party is going through, that if he can sort of get even a small percentage of the numbers of people who voted for him at the general election, it actually could be something, this party?
Well, I think there was certainly the opportunity there. The trouble is that, you know, he was picking people who or finding himself with people who are essentially dysfunctional. And, you know, trying to create a party is actually a very difficult thing to do, especially when you're running up against an established political machine like the Labour Party is. Now, there was certainly an appetite there to help it, you know, if it looked for some more support amongst the trade unions, I think there was a possibility that they could have shifted that. But I think time has moved on. You know, Jeremy's not the youngest politician. He had his day. And I just feel, as I was saying earlier, I just feel that the dial has now shifted to the Greens. You know, we've got a young-ish charismatic leader. He's very much in the same territory. They've got an established political machine, established brand, and they seem to be kind of hoovering up what your party, or whatever it, you know, ends up being called, would have done in different circumstances. So I just wonder now if it's too late.
Yes, how much do you think age is a factor? Because polling before an election is all well and good. I mean, if for Zach from the Greens is polling at whatever it is, 15 or plus percent, then that's people saying what they would do if they went out to vote. But as we know, young people are much less likely to vote than older people. And might Jeremy Corbyn actually appeal to those around his age, and Zach appeal to those around his own age who are less likely to go out and vote on the day?
I think the problem is that actually Jeremy Corbyn appealed to a much younger audience than his own. And in fact, the older voters were tended to break towards the Conservatives back in his elections anyway. And then on to the Labour Party, they tend to look for more stability than experimentation. And you know, where Jeremy had the biggest kind of rallies and support was always kind of university campuses and things like that. So, as I say, I think his big problem is that he and the Greens are essentially going down the same route, the same area, and are competing in that respect. And I think the Greens are in just much better place to, you know, really capitalise on what is a, you know, afraid to say, just 18 months, a desperately unpopular and poorly run Labour government.
Do you think we are on the cusp of a complete revolution in this country as far as the makeup of Parliament is concerned. That the say you that your party joined with the Greens in order to try to keep Farage out of number 10, and that the two main parties or groups would be therefore on the current polling Reform and the Greens slash your party, and Labour and the Conservatives would be sent to the corner of irrelevance.
Well, I saw a poll in the last week or so which put Labour and the Conservatives around 36% combined, which is, you know, only just over a third. I mean, there is no doubt that the centre is collapsing in this country and that people are turning their backs on the mainstream parties. Now, that's not to say that will stick for a general election, but it's quite possible it will, because there's, you know, the last Conservative government really shot its credibility completely at the end of about 14 years with a Boris Liz Truss, and then, you know, Rishi Sunak wasn't actually as bad, but it was far too late for him to patch things together. And then, you know, and I'm afraid this Labour government has just shown themselves incapable in 18 months. And so there is actually a very good chance. I mean, the trouble is that both Reform and the Greens at the moment and your party will all be over-polling. I would imagine, speaking, you know, having the conversations I've had with pollsters and things, that Reform on a good day is probably looking at mid-20s rather than early 30s. And the Greens are probably nearer to 10 than they are to 20. But it's but you never quite know. And of course, we've got elections in May coming up, which I think are going to be very good for both those parties and will give them some sort of momentum. So, you know, it is quite possible that we could end up with a kind of Green Your Party coalition versus a Reform on the right with the centrist parties. Well, you know, really adrift.
Do you think it's also possible that people are now, when responding to pollsters, expressing their displeasure, but when it comes down to it, the British small-c conservatism will lead them to putting a tick in the box of the traditional, or one of the boxes of the traditional two big parties?
Yeah, I think that's very likely. I think it's more likely than not. But I don't know if that will be enough for them, either of them, to form a majority of the next election. I think the way things are, unless, you know, even Labour or Conservatives really dramatically change how they're doing things and sort themselves out, the way things are, we're probably looking at a hung parliament with, you know, different coalitions of the left or right potentially running the show afterwards. You know, which we, you know, we could say the Conservatives and Reform get together. We could see Labour having to do a deal with the Greens and your party or the Lib Dems, something like that, or even the SNP up in Scotland. You know, it's certainly completely open. I mean, it's probably more open than it has been at any time in our lives. I mean, you've got to remember, only once in our history, as a democracy, has a major party been replaced by another one properly, and that was 100 years ago when Labour replaced the Liberals. And, you know, so that was literally the one-off in our politics. And, you know, we could be on the verge of something as dramatic and seismic as that.
And just finally, going back to your party, it's all good fun and all, but do you think too much has been made of the various disagreements in the party? I mean, debate and disagreement at this early stage in its development is a good thing, isn't it?
Yes, but no, I'm afraid. I mean, yeah, it probably is a good thing, but I just don't think they've got the time and space to do this. You know, Zara Sultana can't be protesting outside there on day one, outside on the first day of their first ever conference. They're going to persuade people, if they're serious about, you know, sharing in power or getting to power, that they are a party that can actually sort their own stuff out rather than, you know, completely fall into chaos. And I'm afraid the early pictures of chaos won't help them at all. And as I keep going back to this, you know, it comes at a time when the Greens have just suddenly decided to go for one leader, look pretty organised, and are kind of ploughing ahead and of course, taking, hoovering up, really, all these votes, which would have gone to your party otherwise.
Very good to talk to you, David. Thanks so much for your time. So what do you make of this? I guess first impressions are important, and first impressions of your party are pretty negative. I mean, starting with the name that they've chosen, abysmal. Party McParty Face would have been better. But anyway, we're stuck with it. First impressions not that good, but things can change very quickly. And for a party that's just come into being, if polling is right, they're already at 10%. So it can be fashioned into some sort of force to be reckoned with. What do you reckon? 0345 6060 973 LBC.
This is LBC.
Hi, I'm looking for a pair of jeans.
Right. Low slung, slouchy, wide leg, bower leg, curved leg, flared, straight or skinny?
Blue?
Fashion. It's hard to keep on top of. Other things like the upcoming changes to renting are a bit easier. As a landlord, you will need to get on top of these important changes. These changes will affect how you manage your tenancies. Read the guidance at gov.uk/renting-is-changing.
Every investor has a future in mind, whether it's seeing your kids through uni or picturing yourself retiring in Tuscany. The hard part can be knowing how to get there. JP Morgan Personal Investing can help you see the path ahead with our intuitive app, expert support, and 150 years of JP Morgan's investing experience. You can start making more informed investment decisions today. Search JP Morgan Personal Investing. Invest with clarity. Capital at risk.
Nick Abbott on LBC. Call 0345 6060 973.
So the initial days of the Your Party, it's just terrible. That's what we have to call it, the Your Party, have been, well, it could have been improved. Zara Sultana boycotted the first day. Corbyn confirmed to journalists that he preferred a single leader. Zara Sultana did not. Members voted by a whisker for the party to have a collective leadership model. There were also wins for the other positions advocated by Sultana, including for members to be able to have dual membership of other political groups as well, which seems a bit odd to me. Somebody who was there at the conference, I believe, is Samantha, and she's on the phone from Liverpool. Hello, Samantha.
Hello there. I'm afraid I couldn't make it to the conference, but oh. I had five friends there.
Okay.
Who have reported back, and their response is that it was wonderful. Okay, it's messy, it's painful, it's a hard work because it's a birth.
Mm-hmm.
You know, this is the birth of a new party, and it's exciting. There's going to be disagreements. I think it's all healthy at the beginning. And we've allowed people to be, well, I voted for it, people being in two parties, your party and another one. Because let's be honest, if you're in a political party for years, I was in the Labour Party for 40 years, and I cried the day I left. It's hard. So, and your party might just fizzle out. So you can give people a year. They can be in your party and another one for a year. And then after that, they've got to choose your party.
Right. So, yes, while you decide on if it is absolutely for you or not, or whether the party eventually strikes out in the right direction, then you can sort of hedge your bets.
Yes. Why not?
Vote for you could wear the scarf of United and City.
Well, it's not quite that. I think most people are going to be in a left-wing party and your party, because I think that division is too, let's face it, they're never going to be friends.
Right.
But we will be. I think I'm just pleased that I've found another political home. I'm a socialist. I'm Labour, you know, I said I left Labour and somebody said to me, no, they left you.
Hmm. What do you make of the Green Party now, the sort of revivified Green Party?
Excellent. If there's no your party candidate, I will vote Green every time.
Now, is that a new feeling or is it simply, or is it rather something that you came to the conclusion after you'd seen Zach Polanski?
No, I'd thought of that before,
right.
Because if you look at their manifesto at the last election, they are socialists, really, but with that extra environmental oomph about them.
Mm. Well, what would you think if the Your Party, that's just so bad, that name, but the Your Party joined with the Greens in a sort of a coalition to try to prevent the outcome of Nigel Farage entering Downing Street?
Well, I think it's the only way to go, isn't it? And I don't think they'll stand against each other in local elections next time. Yeah, that would be wrong, because that just splits the vote.
Your friends who went there... sorry to interrupt, but your friends who went to the conference, what did they say about the mood of the place?
They said it was great. They've really enjoyed it. And in fact, one of my mates got up and spoke. She was the last speaker on the second day.
Oh, yeah.
So I've watched her, and I was so proud to have a friend doing that. And there was this councillor from Garston in Liverpool, which is one of the most deprived areas. She's wonderful. She's an independent councillor, an independent socialist. And she was fantastic. So the speeches were inspiring, and apparently the atmosphere was good, and even the food.
Ah. Well, that's always a bonus.
Well, I've been to conference before, Labour, and also my trade union conferences, and I was really sorry not to be able to go.
Right.
So next time, I'll be there.
Okay, I'll see you at the tea bar. Thanks a lot, Samantha. 0345-6060-973. We're talking about... Are we really have to call it the Your Party? Because Your Party doesn't quite convey precisely what it is that we're talking about. So the Your Party actually does make it more clear, but it's just so clunky. So they're going to have to get over that. It's an impediment to liking them, for sure. But it is a nascent party, and they seem to have made waves, certainly. A lot of publicity has been attached to them. And according to polling, they're already at 10%. Now, you can't put much store in that, but if that's true, then that vote will come from Labour, I would think, making it even harder to make up the numbers to defeat Farage for the Labour Party. I wonder if a left-wing party might usher Nigel Farage into number 10 just by splitting the vote. 0345-6060-973. Bath. Hello, John.
Hi, how you doing?
Good, thanks.
I'll have to be succinct because I'm in the middle of baking bread.
Oh.
I actually contacted Jeremy Corbyn because of the name, Your Party.
Hmm.
And I suggested, why don't you just come out with what you want to call it, True Labour? But anyway, it's such an interesting
thing. Did you get a response?
I get bounced around. I'm not a fan, particularly. My children, oddly enough, were in that diaspora that
Glastonbury. Jeremy Corbyn. They were singing that.
Yeah, they joined the Labour Party when he was in, you know, and they kind of went along with him.
Mm.
And I could kind of see that he was going to be demonised and it wasn't going to work and whatever. But I'm disappointed slightly. I mean, you know, this Zara Sulaiman...
Sultana.
He was being interviewed a couple of days ago and he was asked to say whether, is she your friend? And he denied he wouldn't answer it.
Jeremy Corbyn wouldn't answer the question, is Zara Sultani your friend?
Yes.
Right.
And I just thought, is this what we've come to? This is the opposition. Is this what we've come to? And everyone keeps talking about Zach Polanski.
Well, maybe, on that, you know, there's so many people calling for more honesty in politics. And then if he's honest, he gets criticised for being for that honesty.
No,
maybe if she's
that.
He's not his friend, maybe she's just a colleague.
Well, I don't mind that, but he got into bed with her.
So to speak.
Do the party. Right. You know, it looks a bit careless. And the thing is, you know, Zach Polanski, you know, I don't know what barrel he's descended into, but is he what passes for charismatic now?
Well, he certainly is achieving a lot of...
It won't last.
Well, yeah. You seem certain of that, John, but I don't think there's anything certain in politics. And there was nothing certain about the spectacular rise of the Greens very lately under his leadership. And he seems to have a handle on addressing a certain youth audience through some very clever internet videos that he's put out. And if he can keep doing that, then I think a breakthrough for the Green Party is long overdue, considering that by most experts' account, one of the major things that is threatening humankind are green issues. So I think that sort of a breakthrough of some sort for the Greens is long overdue, and he just might be, on current evidence, the man to fashion it. Thanks, John. 0345-6060-973. You can text 84850, email nick@lbc.co.uk. And if you are on WhatsApp, then it's the same number as the phone, 0345-6060-973. It's 11:30 on LBC, the news headlines with Tim Daly.
President Trump's Secretary of State says today's talks on ending the war in Ukraine have been about securing the country's future. Marco Rubio's been speaking after receiving a delegation from Kyiv in Florida. A man's died after falling overboard from a vessel in the English Channel. A body's been recovered after it happened off the coast of East Sussex. And Downing Street says the Prime Minister is to set out how last week's budget will push the government's programme of national renewal. Sir Keir Starmer's due to give a speech tomorrow following widespread criticism of Rachel Reeves' measures and claims about the UK's finances. LBC weather clear and frosty for eastern parts of the country for a time before milder weather pushes into the country. That will bring wet and windy conditions from the west. We'll see a low of around 6 degrees.
LBC.
Hi, I'm looking for a pair of jeans.
Right. Low slung, slouchy, wide leg, bower leg, curved leg, flared, straight or skinny?
Blue?
Fashion. It's hard to keep on top of. Other things like the upcoming changes to renting are a bit easier. As a landlord, you will need to get on top of these important changes. These changes will affect how you manage your tenancies. Read the guidance at gov.uk/renting-is-changing.
If you bought a home on a holiday park in the UK, what you thought you were getting may not be what you ended up with. From unexpected site fee increases, running costs, a huge depreciation in value, many owners feel they've been missold. If you think this might be you, holidayparkadvicecentre.co.uk could help you receive the compensation you're entitled to. Text ASSIST to 78900 to find out more. That's ASSIST to 78900.
There's an old Thai saying that roughly translates as, the family who takes the internet on holiday can locate a less crowded beach. Particularly handy, my friend, if it's peak mating season for nippy little crabs. Pack the internet with an eSIM from Aerolo. That's A-I-R-A-L-O.
Leading Britain's conversation, Nick Abbott. Alexa, send a comment to LBC.
As you may have heard, LBC legend Brian Hayes has died. Susan says, I remember Brian Hayes from 1981 when I listened to LBC after my shift as a nurse at Mayday Hospital in Croydon. Even then, he was a legend. Very pleased to have rediscovered LBC recently. Still an outstanding broadcaster. Thanks, Susan. Nigel says, regarding Brian Hayes, in our house growing up, the radio was always on, a constant stream of Brian Hayes, Ray Moore, Terry Wogan, Ken Bruce, Jimmy Young, John Dunn, and latterly Johnny Walker. As a mum of four and a housewife, they were my mum's friends and were the soundtrack to our childhood. R.I.P. Brian Hayes. Paul says, loved Brian Hayes, LBC legend. Jan says, I hear Brian Hayes has died, just wanted to register my condolences to his family and friends and say, contrary to his often gruff presentation style, he couldn't have been kinder when I was a guest on his LBC programme many moons ago. And Alex says, so sad to read that Brian Hayes, or as Private Eye characterised him, Brian Batard, with a couple of asterisks in there. Sad to hear that he's died. Have you got a clip of him saying rubbish to a caller? Would love to hear it one last time. Unfortunately, Alex, not on me. No, I don't. Plymouth. Hello, Julie.
Hello, Nick. Condolences to that man's family and friends. I'm afraid I didn't hear him, but he sounds wonderful.
Well, he was a pioneer.
I really enjoyed him.
He was definitely a pioneer.
Oh, well, very sad loss. Nick, your party. I used to live in Coventry, and Zara Sultana used to be an MP in Coventry for the Labour Party before she became an independent. So I've sort of followed her a bit. Because I'm originally from Coventry, so I live in Plymouth now, but I still have a keen interest. And she always comes across as a bit militant to me, a little bit combative, and I'm not keen on that style. So I'm not holding out much hope, because, as you say, Jeremy Corbyn, he did get so many votes, but never got into power, and I think his ship may have sailed. So,
by dint of his age?
Well, not so much that, it's just he didn't really make it.
He didn't, that's true, but it was a pretty successful failure, which I know it's an odd thing to say. First time around in 2017, he got 12,877,918 votes. Second time around, 10,269,051 votes. Now, the only other Labour leader going all the way back to James Callaghan in 1979, who got more votes than Jeremy Corbyn, was Tony Blair the first time round in 1997. You remember that, right?
Yes, I did vote for Labour then.
Yeah.
I didn't vote for Jeremy Corbyn. I voted Liberal Democrat.
Right.
Then. I just couldn't vote for him. I just felt that he was too far left and a little more socialist.
But so many people did, though. When he got 12-odd million, 40% of the country voted for the man. Only 33% voted for Keir Starmer.
I think he brought, like, Zara, probably a university youth with him. At that time, lots of young people were sort of voting in his direction, and I think that's probably when Zara came into politics. But I don't know if now that they would be appealing to enough people, because it's so fractious in this country, politics, at the moment. I want to stay sort of centre ground as much as I can, but I don't see the Tories as centre ground after 14 years of them.
No.
So I quite like the Green chap.
If the Greens sort of teamed up with your party? Because if your party is polling at 10%, let's say that there's truth in that, and the Greens are at, 15? It depends on what poll you look at. I mean, that's a quarter of the population right there.
Yes, I would do that if it meant keeping reform out, but I'm not sure I would do it at the cost of the Labour Party. But I would definitely keep reform out, and I'd go happily with your party and the Greens, or the Liberal Democrats and the Greens, because nobody wants reforming, hopefully. So, yes, fingers crossed.
Well, nobody you know wants reform. A few people do, apparently. But I think their polling is maybe flattering them at the moment. But the only way to find out is at the next election. We'll see. All right, good talking to you, Julie. Thank you for that. 0345-6060-973, Bournemouth. Terry.
Hiya, Nick. Just very quickly, before we go on to Jeremy Corbyn, I'd echo that about poor old Brian Hayes. First ever talk radio station I ever got into years ago when I lived in London.
Oh, yeah.
Yeah. But moving on, we're having a repeat, aren't we, of the old left issues with the Labour Party. They, I think you might have even coined the phrase once before, the circular firing squad. Because that
I didn't coin it. I may have used it a lot, but I certainly didn't come up with it.
But, you know, that could be their new name, the circular firing squad party, because they're just not going about it right. It's such a shame because there's so many dedicated people that want to see something a little bit more on a socialist model to be brought into this country to combat the, you know, the billionaires in a way they're absolutely sacking this country. And they're just arguing and bickering amongst each other. Those people that are on the left that don't want this oligarchy to finally take over really need to get their act together and stop bickering and actually get behind each other and do something. Maybe the Greens, maybe Zach Polanski can pull it off, but...
It is typical of the left, though, isn't it? I mean, it's exactly what you would expect. They all wrestle each other to the ground in a fight about purity of thought.
Yeah. Yeah.
And the right wing step nimbly over their writhing forms and take the tape.
I think so. The thing is, as well, is I think reform are getting so much traction because you're getting factions within the country that are concerned about the so-called British worker. Well, there's British workers that have come here from all over the place that everyone needs to be looked after. Everyone needs a health service. It doesn't matter where you come from. If you're here and you're working and you're contributing, or if you know, if you're disabled, you can't contribute, but... We need protecting. We really do, because if we end up with a Trump-style America instead of what's left of social morals in Britain, I think I'm going to go. I've had enough. It's really getting scary now.
Well, yes, and if people think that a Trump-style government would be good for this country, then I would direct them to the internet, where they can see thousands of videos of people crying into their phones because they voted for Donald Trump, thinking that he was going to be cruel to other people, and it turns out he's been cruel to them.
Can I just say one more thing, Nick?
Yes, Terry.
I've been thinking this for a long time. If they can sell us Brexit, they can sell us a privatised National Health Service, and that really scares me.
You should be scared. I was, as I said earlier on in this programme, I was reading about a woman whose child was ill, and they called an ambulance, took him to the hospital, and the bill for the ambulance was $9,000.
Oh, God.
Yeah. So be careful what you wish for. People that would prefer an insurance-based system. Thanks, Terry. Westminster, Hassan.
Hello.
Yes, sir.
So, look, I got inspired into politics by Corbyn, and I wish him well. I'm now a Green. A lot of the Greens are former Corbynites who left Labour dejected by Starmer and the direction. And so it's not been pretty what has been happening with your party, but I wish them well. And I hope that they will increase the overall quantum of left-wing vote so that what the Greens were polling at, which is about 18% or so, becomes 22% or 25%. And as long as we work with your party and make sure that that vote doesn't get split, then we can actually provide an alternative vision of hope to the country, which is clearly lacking that, because the alternatives are reform and their sort of rabid right-wingness, and Starmer, who just seems to be copying reform as much as possible, like Shabana Mahmood.
Well, you could say that. You could say that they are addressing people's sort of widely felt concerns about sort of unrestricted immigration, which of course peaked under Boris Johnson, the Conservative Party. They started this off with Brexit, which is the big problem. We couldn't return people. We had less sovereignty from leaving. But you say that it, without splitting the vote, but isn't the emergence of a new sort of wing of the left of the political spectrum doing just exactly that, splitting the vote?
No, if they that would only split the vote if they compete with each other. But if they form an electoral alliance, I think that could work quite well. Because right now what you have is Zach shows up at his TV studio and there are four forms of right-wingers in front of him. Reform, Tory, Labour, which is actually now very much right of centre, and Lib Dems, who are not particularly sort of, we don't know what they stand for.
Right. Well, I think we do pretty much know what they stand for. Lib Dems are right in the middle, and I wouldn't say that the Labour Party, I mean, I know that people have said this, but I don't think they know what they're talking about. The Labour Party is not a right-wing party. But,
no, but you've seen Shabana's changes? I mean, do you think those are a party of the left?
I don't think a party of the left necessarily has to do absolutely everything that somebody on the left would recognise as being left-wing. I mean, there's shades depending on which issue is at hand. But I'm interested to know why you now said that you were a Green Party supporter. How long ago did you join that party?
Look, I joined about 3 years ago.
Pre-Zach.
Pre-Zach. But if you look at the Greens, I think they have had, their leadership election was in September, and they had 60,000 members. Since then, now they're at about 175. And all these 115,000 are predominantly your party supporters who just got tired of waiting. But all of us sort of have a very high regard for Corbyn. We do see his long history of supporting left-wing causes, and we will work alongside him. And we will not sort of let us be divided. So I think that's the hope for the West, for the left. And I think it's just important. And I think your party is also in a predicament because elections are due in May. There are people who will be standing under various platforms of smaller independent parties like Hackney Independence and Newham Independence and Burnley Independence. So all of those people should be given the right to campaign and participate in elections rather than get subsumed in this large your party structure, which doesn't know whether they'll even be standing candidates under their brand or not. So I think it's not pretty, but I'm glad at least it got done. And let's hope we can try and eliminate the chances of fracturing amongst the left-wing vote.
Good to talk to you, Hassan. Thanks for that. 0345 6060 973 LBC.
Nick Ferrari at breakfast on LBC.
His numbers add up.
6-7. 6-7. Everyone here, you're doing page 6-7.
But to hers.
Today, I will maintain all income tax and equivalent national insurance thresholds at their current level for a further 3 years.
The Chancellor pulls the plug on playtime as she knocks 6-7 bells out of the pay packets of working people. How fair is the welfare budget and could she come back for more?
Can you assure my listeners now, no more tax increases?
Look, no Chancellor can predict the future or write next year's budget.
Nick Ferrari at breakfast. Back tomorrow morning from 7. Listen on our free Global Player app or the new LBC app.
40 million people listen to commercial radio each week. That's 80 million ears, give or take. Amplify your advertising at radiocentre.org.
When it comes to retirement advice, the last thing you want is to be put in a bucket. Seen as this type of person or that type of person. At Fisher Investments UK, we never put you in a bucket. We always tailor retirement advice that's just right for you. Fisher Investments UK. Retirement advice that's as individual as you are. Learn more at fisherinvestments.co.uk. Investing involves the risk of loss. Fisher Investments UK is regulated by the UK Financial Conduct Authority.
When you're smiling.
Banning Dental Group Clinics. With over 5,000 top-rated Google reviews. Keep on smiling.
Hi, I'm looking for a pair of jeans.
Right. Low slung, slouchy, wide leg, bower leg, curve leg, flared, straight or skinny?
Blue?
Fashion. It's hard to keep on top of. Other things like the upcoming changes to renting are a bit easier. As a landlord, you will need to get on top of these important changes. These changes will affect how you manage your tenancies. Read the guidance at gov.uk/renting-is-changing.
This is LBC. With Nick Abbott.
We are talking about your party. Not your party, but your party. That's never going to get comfortable to say or hear, is it? But anyway, that's what they've decided on. And initially, first impressions are that it is somewhat chaotic, but it is perhaps inevitable that a new political party are going to be riven with debate and discussion and disagreement until they get their ducks in order, and then they will present a more coherent face to the world. But what do you think of the prospects of the this your party at the moment, and what do you make of the idea that they're not going to be run by one person, it's going to be a collective leadership? Does a party, particularly a new one, not need a single personality for the public to focus on, as has been the case with the Green Party, which has achieved success the likes of which it has not seen before under the charismatic leadership of Zach Polanski? Terrington St. Clement. Peter.
Hello, Nick.
Peter.
Yeah, interesting show. Yeah, I'm interested in what you've been saying about your party and the dual membership. My take on it is, from what I've heard and read, is that the dual membership is largely about including the revolutionary left. As you know, it's not about having the Greens or Labour Party members in it, and you know, stuff like that. It's including the revolutionary left, and the revolutionary left doesn't stand at elections. So that's what it's largely about. There's a lot of very good activists in the various groups, the Counterfire Group, Socialist Worker Party Group, RS21. There's three examples. And members of those organisations got told they were expelled, or some of them did anyway.
Mm.
And who's made that decision to expel them? We haven't had a vote. You know, the vote hadn't taken place at conference. And that's been sort of overruled now, which I think is good. But, yeah, that's the idea of it anyway. It's a socialist party from the bottom up and should include all socialists, whether they're in the Counterfire Group, SWP, or whatever. You know, we want good socialists in it.
What do you make of the idea of...
I'm inclined to agree with you about the name, though, Nick.
Yeah.
Your party's perhaps not the best name they could have had.
Terrible.
That's not the most important thing. The most important thing is it's going to be policies, you know, how policies decided and what politics we come up with. So,
and what do you make of this fight about whether it's going to be represented by one person or a collection of people?
I think you have a collection of people, you make it more democratic in many ways. Say it's bottom-up bottom-up party rather than top-down. And I think it needs to be that way. I think that's... Although I am inclined to agree with you about the Green Party, what you said about their leader. He's quite good. And, you know, I would advise, where there's not your party candidate standing in elections and there's a Green Party, vote for the Greens if that's what you feel. But it's not just about elections, you see. We don't want a Labour Party Mark II. We want politics to be ongoing on a sort of a daily and weekly basis, not just members turning out at election times and putting a leaflet through somebody's door.
Right.
There's much more to politics than just that.
Okay, good talking to you, Peter. Thanks for that. Got to move on. Epsom, hello, Anne.
Hello, thank you for taking my call.
Anne.
I was thinking, people are kind of saying about, Jeremy Corbyn's good and all that, but in 2014, he attended a reflame ceremony at the Palestinian Martyr Cemetery, and he actually laid a wreath there. Now, how can someone be decent who's laying wreaths where, you know, for terrorists?
I don't think he laid wreaths for terrorists. I'm not overly familiar with what it is you're talking about, but I don't think that he was laying wreaths for terrorists. I think he was laying wreaths for the recently departed.
He was present when a wreath was laid for others.
Right.
In Paris, but the thing is, there was a big thing about it, and people were really annoyed. And this is why the only person that will get this country astray is Nigel Farage.
I felt that you were going to say that. And why do you say that? What is it about Nigel Farage that will get this country straight, whatever that means?
Because I know people don't like him. I know, like, your LBC don't seem to like the chap. But the thing is, look what Conservative done, look what Labour have done, the state our country's in, we're getting people over on boats every day.
Yeah, but you understand that that is Nigel Farage's fault. He brought us out of the European Union before we shot ourselves in the foot with Brexit. We could return those people. Specifically because of Nigel Farage, we can't.
But we never really heard about it before this.
What do you mean?
Well, we never heard about these people coming across.
Yes, because they didn't. They only started doing that once we left the European Union, and they knew that we couldn't send them back.
Oh, I never knew that. But I would still vote Nigel Farage.
Right, regardless of him being the reason of the complaints that you've just made.
Yeah.
That makes no sense.
Well, no. It
sounds like you joined a cult.
No, he probably would write them what he'd done wrong.
So, right. Right. So, okay. All right, I've got to move on, Anne, because it's just too painful. Leonard says, "Dear Nick, it's not just Starmer and his party. It is Westminster in its entirety that needs to go, and the sooner they are all gone, the better." There's another guy who wants a dictator to take over. Terry in Bournemouth says, "Perhaps, Nick, the geniuses at your party should have called themselves the Circular Firing Squad Party. Shame, because we really need some socialist principles and investment in this Tory broken country." Well, it's not the name is a bit of a put-off, but the name isn't the it of it, though, is it? I mean, it doesn't help that they call themselves that, but we're going to have to look beyond it. And Andrew says, "I thought Jeremy Corbyn's Peace and Justice Project was a good name for the party." And Andrew says, "The Labour of Love Party." Let's see. Waltham Forest, Anup.
Yes, hello. I called in because of the discussion about your party. I just want to say that I think we should be giving them more of a chance. I feel like every little thing that actually needs to happen to go wrong, it's like it's made into a big thing and look, they can't do anything. But I think they've got some really refreshing ideas that the political class don't seem to want to think about or even discuss. And, you know, like taking the trains back and utilities back, it's not necessarily a bad idea, I don't think. It's gone, you know, like, just give them a chance, let them try it.
Yes, well, I mean, I have said multiple times that perhaps we are making too much of the disagreements of a nascent party. They're bound to be disagreements at first before they have a chance to, you know, get some sort of organisation and some coherent message out. Yeah, bound to be.
Yeah, and I mean, look, we clearly the country wants change. That's what I guess Nigel Farage and Reform are kind of representing. But is it really the right kind of change that's actually going to change anything?
Mm. Well, I don't know. You have to ask yourself, how did Brexit go? Because that's Nigel Farage's signature policy. And badly is the answer to that question. If you want more of that, then carry on. Thanks, Anna. Farnham. Hello, Mark.
Nick, hi there. Good evening. How are you?
Good, thanks.
Firstly, to your colleague, Brian Hayes, rest in peace to his family and his loved ones. Before I make my point, if I may, and we can all be guilty of this, you phrased Nigel Farage a couple of seconds ago, and I'm no supporter of him necessarily, but you phrased him as the reason for Brexit.
Well, it's the thing that people associate more than anything else with Nigel Farage, isn't it?
And totally agree.
Yeah.
But you said specifically he was the reason. I'll remind people that politically he wasn't an MP and he had no political influence at that point.
Oh, yes, he did.
Another point.
Yes, he did. He had an enormous amount of political influence. He pretty much single-handedly made that happen.
I don't disagree, but politically, he couldn't enforce Brexit, could he?
Well, he couldn't force it, no.
No, enforce it politically.
No, he could not enforce it, no.
But so you're saying one man made us leave Europe despite not being a Member of Parliament?
Yeah.
Okay, which I don't disagree with. And then can I go to my main point?
Please.
I'm not disagreeing. but we talk about your party, right? It's kind of my point. So we look at Corbyn. He's now has this party jointly. They choose their name. We look at his election performance under Labour, okay? So 2017, if you look at his stats, there's an argument he was about 2,500 votes away from being able to have a government that would have required five other parties to enable it. In 2019, he delivered the worst performance for like 100 years.
Well, it depends on what you're talking about. If you're talking about percentage of vote, then perhaps. If you're talking about the number of votes collected, then he did better than anybody going back to 1979, apart from Tony Blair. Including Keir Starmer.
It was the worst result since 1935.
Well, 10,269,051 votes, which is higher than anybody except Tony Blair in 2001 and 1997.
On that, sir, I'll agree with you. And this comes to my central point.
I'll have to hurry you, Mark, because I'm...
Yeah, really quickly.
Yeah.
I think the middle ground is so lost in this country that we're now forming different parties. We're going left, we're going right, we're going here, we're going there. The facts remain, there's no centre party because we don't have a common aim. You're either left or you're right.
I suspect that that's not actually how people feel, but I think it's how people have been almost dragooned into thinking of themselves by the malign influence of social media. That seems to be their business model, to divide us. I suspect that most of us are in the middle. The vast majority, I get the feeling. We always have been. But thanks for that, Mark. Plenty more opportunities to talk about this. But coming up after the news, are you dreading the chaos of Christmas? A psychotherapist has said this time of year could give you a bigger emotional hangover than you are expecting. Are you feeling the stress this festive season? I'll talk to a man who has a way to make it less stressful.
On your radio, on the LBC app, and...
Play LBC.
Leading Britain's conversation. This is LBC.
From Global's newsroom at midnight. President Trump's Secretary of State has been describing Sunday's talks with Ukraine in Florida as productive and successful. They've included more discussions about steps to end the conflict with Russia. Following last week's meetings in Geneva, Kyiv's lead negotiator is Rustem Umerov.
We are thankful for the efforts of United States and its team to helping us. U.S. is hearing us, U.S. is supporting us, U.S. is walking beside us, and we are thankful for all what has been done until today.
The Prime Minister is due to say last week's budget will ensure economic stability after widespread criticism of Rachel Reeves' measures. He'll give a speech later on today. The Chancellor's been denying claims she misled the country over its finances during the lead-up to her announcements on Wednesday. A man has died after falling overboard from a vessel in the English Channel. It happened off the coast of New Haven in East Sussex just before Sunday lunchtime. A body has been recovered. Israel's Prime Minister has asked for a pardon from the country's president over his long-running corruption trial. Benjamin Netanyahu has been facing charges of bribery, fraud and breach of trust, but has denied any wrongdoing. But the Middle Eastern journalist Noga Tarnopolsky has been telling LBC the law may not be able to give him what he wants.
Prime Minister Netanyahu announced he allowed his lawyers to request a pardon on his behalf. That's what he said. It's unclear that this actually is a request for a pardon under currently existing Israeli law.
An amber weather alert warning of a possible danger to life in large parts of Wales has now come into force. It will run for the next 24 hours after being extended by the Met Office. It's warning the majority of South Wales could experience fast flowing and deep floodwaters. And the death has been announced of the former LBC broadcaster, Brian Hayes.
You know the telephone number. If you don't, I'll remind you. It's 0719739733. If you'd like to join now, our discussion of some of the issues of the week. And today with us, a director of the Reject Shop, businessman Anthony Hauser, and also Woman's Own columnist Alex Palmer. They've selected a number of issues to discuss, hear what they have to say, and then you call in with your ideas.
He was 87 years old and helped to pioneer the radio phone-in in the UK during his three decades here at LBC. LBC weather, clear and frosty in eastern areas for a time before milder weather arrives. That will bring wet and windy conditions in from the west. We'll see a low of around 6 degrees. From Global's newsroom, for LBC, I'm Tim Daly.
This is LBC from Global, leading Britain's conversation with Nick Abbott.
Joseph Conway is a psychotherapist and mental health trainer with more than 15 years' experience. He wrote a column in the I paper about the stresses involved with this time of year in the build-up to a particular date in about a month's time. Let's talk about all of that with Paul Gallagher, the health journalist and broadcaster who joins us on the line now. Hello, Paul.
Yeah, hi, Nick.
Why is Christmas such a stressful time? Is it the nature of the event itself, or do we actually cause the stress within ourselves?
I think it's a combination of both of those factors, Nick. I think people inevitably put a lot of pressure on themselves to come up with a perfect Christmas, all the more so now in the light of social media. And this striving for perfectionism that a lot of people want to achieve at this time of year. It's costly. Every parent will know that. Every member of somebody who's in a large family with lots of siblings to buy presents for, lots of nieces and nephews. And nobody wants to feel left out. Then you throw into the fact that, you know, if you're hosting, whether you're not hosting, but if you are hosting and you've got a lot of people to cater for, perhaps not just on Christmas Day, but on Boxing Day, various other days throughout the Christmas holidays. It's all about the preparation, getting all the food and drink right. It all adds up. It can be incredibly stressful time. There's no other time of the year quite like it. I think a lot of people assume it's, and for a lot of people it is, the best time of year, but for other people it's, you know, incredibly stressful time of the year, especially if you don't plan ahead.
Yes, that notion that it's the best time of the year is stressful in itself, because if you don't have the best time of the year, then you feel as though you've failed in some way.
Yeah, that's right. People, as I say, put a lot of pressure on their own shoulders to make sure everything goes absolutely perfectly. And how many Christmases do that? I mean, it is a tough time. It can be a great time. I think a large part of it comes down to planning and preparation. I mean, it goes down, it's perhaps obvious to say, but if you've never actually cooked for 20 people before, it might be an idea to perhaps practice one or two things that yes. You can do ahead of time. I mean, there's this assumption that you have to prepare everything on the day itself. But I was just listening to Jamie Oliver on the radio the other day, just singing the praises of cooking your roast potatoes in advance, getting them in the goose fat and then freezing them, you know, for a few weeks. So you just literally pop them in the oven on the morning. It's small things like this that can go a long way to making sure your Christmas day is much more enjoyable than it otherwise would be.
Yeah, you mentioned the role of social media, and no doubt it will be absolutely full of images of tweezered perfection, which isn't really people's reality. It's staged for the camera, you know, in much the same way as people spend hours perfecting their selfie pout. It's an unreasonable thing to against our own efforts, though, isn't it? Because we're always going to come up wanting.
Yeah, I think it's especially a factor for, I mean, speaking as a parent myself, I think there's an assumption that your children are going to be doing a lot of more, perhaps there's a lot more competition amongst children now in terms of not only what day they've had over Christmas Day, Boxing Day, but also what presents they're getting in advance as well. Of course, lots of children at school talk to each other about what they've got on their on their Santa wish lists, and I know from experience there's quite a range of prices in terms of the cost of these presents amongst a lot of the children go for. Then, of course, you throw into the mix that, you know, a social media for older children, teenagers, as well. It's difficult to manage. It's not insurmountable by any stretch of the imagination. I would suggest putting a budget on what you can afford, set out how many presents you've got to buy. I'm speaking personally, somebody in a very large family, one of five siblings, and when we started having the next generation, one or two more of them coming through, we just ended the fact that we were getting presents for all the brothers. I'm one of five brothers, and it just got slightly ridiculous, and we just decided, look, let's change this, let's do a secret Santa for the siblings, and then just concentrate on getting presents for the kids, because it was just getting, quite frankly, ridiculous. We were looking at buying 20 to 25 presents just to put around the tree. So it does come a time when you've got to say, look, let's change what we've done in the past. Everybody loves their traditions around Christmas. But if it's getting a bit too silly, it's getting a bit too costly, don't be afraid to say, no, look, we need to have a look at another way of doing this thing.
And also the images of Christmas are of plenty, aren't they? I mean, particularly the American ones, and Americans are considerably better off than we are here. And the present giving seems to have got completely out of hand. When I was a kid, you used to get in a stocking some chocolate coins, a tangerine, and then be a present.
Maybe some nuts.
Yes, exactly. Right, yes. But these days, it seems to be almost a competition between parents to see how much they can get their children.
Yeah, and I think that's part of that is an issue. And I think you've just got to set some limits, boundaries yourself. I mean, everybody knows their own children. Everybody knows what expectations they have. And it is a case of managing those expectations. And I think if you go into Christmas, and your children are assuming they're going to get a certain amount of presents or a certain size of present or going to be looking forward to a certain trip away or whatever it is, and you don't meet those, and that, of course, causes a lot of extra stress amongst itself. I think if you have certain conversations amongst your children ahead of the Christmas day itself, you know, don't just rely on, the one present that they've got their heart on from Santa. Come up with a plan B, a plan C, you know, stress the fact that Santa might not be able to carry a certain size TV or computer, whatever it is, on their sleigh. And so you've got a range of choices that the kids are expecting. They're not just all putting their eggs into one basket. And of course, if they don't get that PlayStation 5, they're not necessarily going to be that disappointed.
Yeah, what about Santa? Is it a bit strange in this era of sophisticated children who have devices in their rooms that they can look up the existence or otherwise of Santa Claus that we're still peddling this nonsense?
Oh, Nick, behave yourself. You know, I mean, there was obviously this backlash already against smartphones for children. There's a bit more of a backlash about getting iPads and getting children away from screens and back to sort of the traditional toys and traditional playtime and the playtime childhood, not a smartphone childhood. So, in fact, although we've perhaps gone through the last few years of seeing the average age of a child getting their first smartphone going down to single digits in age, we're starting to see a bit more of a backlash against that. And there is, from what I've seen, certainly from speaking to fellow parents at the school my kids go to and just seeing the general conversations in the national press, we are perhaps moving back towards a bit more of a traditional childhood Christmas and moving away from sort of that electronic tablet iPhone based Christmas, because we're seeing more and more evidence of the potential damage that does getting kids on smartphones and especially on social media, and you know, far younger than is appropriate.
Yeah, I wonder if some of the adults, parents clinging to the Santa story is that they actually quite like it themselves, this sort of a return to a childlike Disney style fantasy land.
Absolutely. I mean, and that would have been the childhood that they themselves have had. I mean, you see it in the toys that the adults now buy, you know, for themselves. You only have to look at the Lego range of Star Wars items that they have now, going up to the new Death Star, which is about £950, and nobody's getting that for their child. You know, a 45-year-old man is going to get that for themselves, not for their child. You know, and that's the kind of image that they want. They want to recreate their own childhood, that sort of pre-information age, that pre-smartphone age era childhood that they enjoy, purely toys-based, family-based Christmas that they had. They want to recreate that for their own children. So that's not surprising.
Yes, now we talk about social media. It has divided us politically, deliberately on the part of the people that run those sites, because it brings in the money.
Yeah.
And at Christmas, of course, unlike any other time of year, pretty much, age differences of relatives who you don't often spend time with are going to be sitting around the table. Now, pour alcohol on that combination, and it's going to be a pretty fraught time on the day, unless they have some sort of coping mechanism.
Yes, indeed. I don't know what that coping mechanism might be. It's an interesting one, isn't it? I mean, this is the one time of the year that perhaps three, sometimes four generations of a family get together. And, of course, the more people there are in that room, the more pressure there is, I think, on the people, especially the host, to make sure that everybody is having a good time. I think, inevitably, everybody realizes that it's not going to be quite this picture postcard Christmas that you see in all the advertisements, but everyone puts in their own effort. And of course, there are last minute hiccups, things don't go to plan, perhaps something is said out of turn. I suppose it all comes down to experience, doesn't it? You know, if you've been through some of these Christmases before, they're more likely to have a more enjoyable Christmas again if you've been hosting 15, 20 people. Although, having said that, perhaps it's not your turn to do so again, you know, and you might want to suggest that you want fancy being a guest this time next year rather than being the host.
Mm. But unlike other holidays, it's unique, isn't it? Because it's a crescendo of activity, all of which is stressful, the cooking, the rushing around looking for presents, all building up to just one day, probably just one morning and afternoon. And then there's a sort of an emotional crash that follows that, isn't there? Is there any coping methods that people can instigate to sort of mitigate the effects of that?
I think people will all come up with something themselves. I mean, maybe somebody's planned a couple of days break, you know, after Christmas Day, Boxing Day, you know, you spent weeks planning this thing, you know, try and just make sure you've got just the house back to yourselves, whoever's living in that house, just you, your husband, wife, or just you yourselves and the children, and make sure you sort of just enjoy two or three days quiet time before New Year's Eve, New Year's Day, when you might be doing exactly the same thing again, because that's not particularly unquiet time in itself. And you might want to plan a bit of a January getaway, a weekend break. You know, having something to look forward to post-Christmas is almost equally as important as it is for many people looking forward to Christmas, because, as you say, as great a time as it is, it will be stressful no matter what, you know, no matter what goes on. So having something to look forward to just ahead of that could be key to, you know, making sure that you get through it better than you otherwise would do.
Yeah, and one of the things that people don't talk about at Christmas, because it is the case before and after it, is the lack of light. The lack of daylight is really starting to have an effect on people, isn't it?
Yeah, there's been countless studies that have shown over the years that people are generally, their mood isn't quite what it is over autumn and winter than it is over the summer. So I suppose spare a thought for people in Scandinavia who don't see the sun for 3 months. But it is generally linked to mood swings, bit extra depression, anxiety, and indeed we've seen that in the other studies that I've covered in the past. In the health beat for people who work night shifts, for example, you know, it's quite a proven incidence that, you know, the less sunlight, the less daylight that you see, it does affect your mood as well. So that's definitely a factor you have to think about this time of year.
And you've had to go through Christmas just like everybody else. Have you found anything that sort of eases the strain?
Oh, let me think. Well, definitely being a guest rather than the host,
right,
if you can. Plan ahead. Make sure you have a budget. Don't be afraid to say no. You know, if somebody wants to come round and you just can't squeeze them in, I've got very close friends who, both the husband and the wife, parents divorced when they were young, remarried and went on to have more children. A few Christmases ago, they made four separate trips to see all different families. And I think that was the point where they realised it was too much. And I said, look, say no to one or two. Say, look, we'll do Christmas Day at yours this year, Boxing Day at the others this year, and then vice versa the following year. So don't be afraid to say, look, this is getting a bit too much. We'll all have a better Christmas if we don't say yes to absolutely everything. Don't be afraid to say no.
Very good to talk to you, Paul. Thanks so much for that. Health journalist and broadcaster Paul Gallagher. So how about you? Does the pressure of having everything to be perfect put too much strain on us? I mean, it's just another day. Have we cornered ourselves into expecting too much? And have you got any tips, anything that helps you get through both the day itself and that and the sort of headlong rush up to it, which I suppose has started already, hasn't it? 0345 6060 973 LBC.
Weekdays from 7 a.m.
Why is there delay?
Straight to the point.
This government is unravelling everywhere you look.
Nick Ferrari at breakfast on LBC.
How can that make sense to anyone?
Listen on our free Global Player app or the new LBC app. Download it now from your app store. LBC.
What if you could send a free chocolate bar in secret to someone special? Just to, you know, give them a little lift. With the Cadbury Secret Santa Postal Service, you can send free chocolates secretly from a poster. They're popping up all over the country. From great big cities to quaint little towns. Look out for a poster near you or search Cadbury Secret Santa to find out more. 18 plus. Free service on selected products while stocks last until 21st December. Visit cadbury.co.uk/terms and conditions for full T's and C's.
The Famous Five are out hiking when Anne spots something through her binoculars. Crikey, it's a gigantic five and a zero. It's the GWR Black Friday sale with up to 50% off tickets, exclaims George. Looks like we're going on our biggest adventure yet. Great Western Railway's Black Friday sale is now on. Book now on gwr.com or on the app. Hurry, sale ends December 1st. Adventures start here. Terms apply, selected routes only, subject to availability, travel by March 13th.
This is LBC with Nick Abbott. Call 0345 6060 973. Text 84850. Alexa, send a comment to LBC.
We are talking about the stress of the season. There's the pressure of feeling that everything has to be perfect at Christmas, put too much strain on us. It is just another day. Have we sort of forced ourselves into a corner of expecting too much? And do we spend too much as well? Has this got completely out of hand? Black Friday, your email inbox has probably been full of messages about Black Friday for weeks now. Black Friday, hurry, hurry, buy now, sale ends soon. Well, it might do, and then they'll take a pause for a moment, and then the Boxing Day sales will start, which these days begin about 2 weeks before Boxing Day. Used to be after Christmas, I seem to remember. Now, if they open their sales after Christmas, everybody's spent all their cash already. So it's like an arms race. That's why Christmas appears to come earlier every year. It's because no retailer wants to miss out on this colossal amount of money that we just throw away at this this time of the season. And have you found any ways to sort of mitigate the stress of this time of year? Maybe checking out of all of this entirely. Sounds pretty good around about now. 0345 6060 973. Greenwich. Hello, Tom.
Oh, Nick. Thank you for letting me onto your show.
Tom.
Yeah, I'm stressed. I remember the days of the 70s when my late mum and dad, who died 5 years ago, and I had lovely Christmases in the 70s and remember them lovely memories. Now I live alone and I get stressed every time Christmas comes up, and I don't know why do I feel that way?
Yeah, why do you feel that way? Stress about what though?
stressed about all the shopping everyone's doing and expectations as well. I don't know. I'm looking for an answer, Nick, from you.
Well, I remember.
Sorry.
I remember Christmases in the 1970s, and I wonder if I think particularly warmly of them, simply because I was younger then, and you view the past through rose-tinted glasses, sort of this misty-eyed recollection of a happier place. But it's happier because you sort of your memory filters out the bad bits.
I agree with you. I just want it to be over. I just want to get through it. I live alone now. So on Christmas Day, all I will be doing is going to my shop that doesn't celebrate Christmas. So just getting a bottle of drink, coming back and doing another day and just getting through it.
It is just another day.
Yeah, sadly.
Well, I don't know. Is it? I mean, it's a kind of obsession. It's almost as though we've forced ourselves into this position of being, sort of determinedly jolly. And it gets a bit wearing after a while if somebody is in the position that you are, Tom. You live on your own. You don't have children running about the place to buy stuff for. So it might not feel very Christmassy, whereas you feel that you should feel Christmassy.
I do. Maybe it's selfish of me. I want to feel it. Maybe it's that way.
Well, I wish you all the best, Tom. Thanks for that. Mark in Aberdeen says, prepare yourself, it's not a happy story. It says, Nick, a family friend was a GP in the north of Scotland. He will never forget one Christmas day at home when a young lad from a couple of doors down frantically knocked on his door asking him to come to his mother. She had fallen in the kitchen. The doctor went to the house to find a woman who had a heart attack and was no longer alive. Ever since then, he has thought of her on Christmas Day when he is worrying about the day. Yes, well, there's always somebody who is going to have it much worse than you, no doubt about that. Archie says, Christmas is just another date on the calendar. Speak to a psychotherapist and it will take on any significance that you want. And Stephen Oldham says, to hell with the expense this Christmas, I'm going to set my budget for presents, food and drink at £20. And I don't mind if I blow the lot, because that's the way I roll, says Steve. Devon, hello, Rose.
Oh, hello, Nick. I just thought I'd ring in, because I was listening to the first chap, Tom. Mm. And I must say, I mean, after many years ago, I was with somebody, Brian, and, you know, we had lovely, cosy Christmases together. But there was this stress, this feeling that, oh, it's got to be beautiful, it's just got to be lovely.
Mm.
And neither of us spent a lot of money, because we didn't have a lot of money. But, you know, it had to be wonderful, just because it was Christmas Day. But for some time now, I've just totally ignored it. I mean, I've been on my own for years now. I did spend it with, oh, mind you, that's what, nearly 20 years ago, when Mother died. I mean, it turned out she died at the end of the next year, as it were. So I was awfully glad I'd spent Christmas with her, you know.
Yeah.
But since then, I've just been by myself. And, I mean, if I was invited anywhere, I wouldn't want, is there something wrong with me? I wouldn't want to bother. I mean, I'd have to catch a train, you know.
Make an effort, yes.
Make an effort.
And it's one of the worst days.
Take no notice of it completely.
Well, yes, it is one of the worst days to do anything other than sit indoors, because nothing is open, the transport is shut down. And oddly, I mean, I come in on Christmas Day to do my show, the A to Z, and
yeah.
I always find that the centre of London is absolutely packed, and it surprises me every year, because there's nothing open. What are these people doing?
How extraordinary. I was waiting for you to say it was completely quiet, and
no.
I was going to say, oh, how lovely.
Not at all.
You know.
No, I guess people are just taking the opportunity to come in when they think there's not going to be many people in to see the lights, and then when they get here, they find it's a crowd.
Yeah, yeah. But I will say again that you know, listening to this now, and that the guest you had, and all the money that people spend, and the, I can remember much, much less than the sort of thing he's talking about, because I never had a family. But it's got to be good. Any sort of that level of stress, all I can feel now is, oh, thank God, I'm not doing all that.
Mm.
I mean, my sister does it, but she does love it, but she does get very stressed beforehand. And I remember her partner saying, I said, you know, I rang up, and he said, oh, she's out doing Christmas. Oh, God, she gets herself in such a state. I'm thinking, why? You know, it's yes. quite a long way. So I wouldn't want to go anyway, because trains. I mean, who wants to sit on a train?
No, exactly.
And sort of be with a family that, you know, I love my sister dearly, but... You know, you'd be out of place, wouldn't
well,
you?
Well, yeah, when you get there, of course, you're stuck there. You can't leave because there are no trains on Christmas Day. Good to talk to you, Rose. Thanks for that. Harrow, Kamal.
Hello, Neil. Hi. First time I've actually listened to your show.
Oh, yes.
This is wake up, but I'm normally asleep by 11, but I had a bit of insomnia actually. But interesting hearing you talk about Christmas. I'm not Christian. I'm religious, but I'm not Christian myself. I'm very spiritual, but I mean to me, I feel that Christmas is a time to think of others who are less fortunate than yourself, and I think all religions teach. Kindness, charity, you know, just being nice, by the way, offering, like, for instance, if you see someone on the street, outside of Tesco, quite often I see someone in my local Tesco, and I always make sure that I stop by and ask him if he's okay, if he needs a coffee or anything, especially this time of year.
Mm.
You know, it's very hard. And, I heard the last caller who was talking about going out on expensive dates. Now, I've been married 5 years now, and I actually met my wife at a Nando's first time. But the first date I took her out was a Nando's. But before I did get married, it was a long journey, probably about maybe 7 or 8 years I was looking on her off. So, and I never used to get that many dates, but when I did, I went through a phase where I would take them to try and impress them by taking them to an expensive restaurant.
And all you needed to do was to go to Nando's. I'm glad it worked out for you, Kamal. I'm afraid I've just run out of time, but thanks for that. After the news, we're going to hear from Washington strategist Rina Shah, who will tell us why Venezuela has just accused Trump of being a colonial threat. Just past 12:30 on LBC, the news headlines with Tim Daly.
The Prime Minister is due to say last week's budget will ensure economic stability after widespread criticism of Rachel Reeves' measures. The Chancellor's been denying claims she misled the country over its finances. President Trump's Secretary of State's been describing Sunday's talks with Ukraine in Florida as productive and successful. They've included more discussions about steps to end the conflict with Russia after last weekend's meetings in Geneva. And the death has been announced of the former LBC broadcaster Brian Hayes. He was 87 years old and helped to pioneer the radio phone-in in the UK during 3 decades at LBC. LBC weather clear and frosty for eastern areas of the country for a while, then milder weather will push in, but it will bring wet and windy conditions from the west. We'll see a low of around 6 degrees.
This is LBC.
We all want to live well and age well. That means having independence and positive choices to enjoy the life you choose. That's what Thrive Living at Botanical Place in West Byfleet is all about. A place of fun, of friendship, in a hive of activity. But above all, it's a supportive community that puts your independence and well-being first. With offers available on apartments to buy and rent, visit the marketing suite or book an appointment at botanicalplace.co.uk.
Get gifting sorted with Black Friday deals on the UK's best network.
I need a present for my bro.
How about saving £960 on the epic Samsung Galaxy S25 Ultra on EE with generative edit?
So he can remove his ex from his photos?
Sure can. Plus, claim a Samsung Galaxy Tab S 10 Lite worth £329, too.
Nice. A little something for me.
Offer ends 4th December.
Savings across contract. Eligibility. Credit check and terms apply. Credit by EE Limited. Claim from Samsung within 30 days of purchase. T's and C's apply. Verify best network at ee.co.uk/claims.
This is LBC with Nick Abbott.
The Venezuelan government has responded defiantly to the heightened pressure by the US government, including Donald Trump's recent statements on Saturday, that the airspace above and surrounding Venezuela is to be closed in its entirety. In the statement, the Venezuelan government said Trump's comments are a colonialist threat. Let's talk about this with Rina Shah. Rina is a US political strategist and commentator and joins us on the line. Hello, Rina.
Hi, nice to be with you.
Appreciate your time. It's odd, isn't it? Trump is going to pardon a former president of Honduras, Juan Orlando Hernandez, a man who was found guilty of conspiring to traffic 400 tons of cocaine to the US. It's about 4.5 billion doses. Yet he also says he's going to kill people who bring drugs into America. Can you make sense of that?
Oh, there's not much to make sense of here. It feels like a quite illogical move. But again, this is kind of what the president is doing in his second term. He seems to be on the world stage making moves that nobody could have really expected. Of course, what's going on with President Trump in Venezuela is certainly being debated in the public square hotly right now, because there is something in the United States that we care a great deal about called due process. So there are people that are calling for the resignation of the Secretary of Defense, Pete Hegseth. He, of course, has renamed the Defense Department as the Department of War, but that's something that requires congressional approval as well. So the way I see it, from an analytical standpoint, I see President Trump taking these very hard-lined actions because what he wants to contrast with the previous administration is expediency as well as harsh action against what he believes are offenses against the United States. That is on the face of what's happening with Venezuela. But now with Honduras, it is very tough to tell exactly why President Trump is taking this time now to, again, deal with somebody that normally we in the United States would not embrace.
Yes, I mean, over and above pardoning one of the biggest, accused and convicted of being one of the biggest drug traffickers in the history of humankind, he's also inserting himself into the business of Honduras and directing people to vote for his favorite candidates. It's not America first, is it?
No, it's not. And I believe there is, well, like with many things, there's something that lies below the surface here. And that's often the case with President Trump and his family. Let's not forget that in the first term, he did not divest from any of his companies. And what we know from that first term, too, is that a lot of the Trump family enriched itself in different deals across the globe, primarily in the Middle East, of course. I don't really quite know what's at stake here for the Trump family. All I can say is I do believe there's a corporate bent here. Like everything else that this president does in his second term, all you've got to do is really follow the money. And when I say follow the money, that there's usually some kind of financial tie to the president taking these actions at this very point in time.
Well, oil is money, and it might be coincidental that Venezuela has by far the biggest oil reserves in the world.
Right, right. And, you know, for the longest time, there have been Republicans, and these Republicans have been dubbed as neocons as well. They have been saying, we need more oil, so let's find it at home. But of course, that's not something we've really heard in this second term from President Trump. I haven't heard the word fracking as much as I perhaps, you know, expected at first. Instead, what I'm seeing in this dealing with Venezuela is that this is about something that is far different. It's not about a regular migration, it's not about really anything else other than the intervention related to how we could profit from the actions that we take there. I really believe at the end of the day, the United States has wanted regime change in Venezuela, whether it was the Biden administration or the Trump administration. But something that I think we all really forget with, how can I put it, with Trump's daily actions is that they don't really follow rhyme and reason. Is this related to regime change when we talk about oil in the same breath? I wouldn't be so sure. I would say this, is that this is a situation where I continue to look at Trump drug war 2.0, essentially, being about boats to borders. I mean, I thought that whole announcement by him turning the Caribbean into a no-fly and no-sail zone for Venezuela was just really a cartel crackdown. I mean, at least that's what this administration is selling it as. And I really say, you know, this, let's look at the numbers too. 20 U.S. strikes since, I think, September. They've killed about 80 alleged traffickers. So there's no other way to look at this than what it is, which is, again, a regime change audition for Nicolas Maduro.
Yes. I mean, they've killed 80 people so far. They said that they were drug traffickers, but it was like the Queen of Hearts and Alice in Wonderland. Verdict first, trial later. It's just plain murder, actually, isn't it, at this point? They're not at war with Venezuela, the U.S. They had no clue as to who it was that was on those boats, nor what they had in the hold, because they blew it up first. So, I mean, there's nothing that's legal about this, really, is there?
There's not, and that is the overarching argument I hear. You know, it's really... Again, this is about migration spike, but there's a global backlash here. The Trump administration keeps saying, you know, what we saw essentially was something like 7 million plus Venezuelan refugees that fueled the U.S. border chaos. That's, again, this administration's words, essentially. And they, again, blame drugs. But what I see, and tying sort of Honduras to Venezuela here, if Maduro falls, Honduras avoids becoming his next export hub for narcos and migrants. So I'll just say this. This is not America first. It's endless escalation. It's risking lives without what should be congressional buy-in. And that's what you hear Senate Democrats warn about. But then again, you sort of look at why Trump does what he does. He wants to be known as the peace president, brokering peace wherever he can. And it just doesn't all add up quite well, because his first term sanctions tanked Venezuela's GDP, something like, I think, over 70%. And that sparked the refugee wave that he now deports en masse. So it's all very, very fascinating to me, because this moment also includes China. China backs Maduro as an intimate friend. But 70% of Americans oppose military action, and I'm seeing that number in recent polls.
Yes. Do you think that actually we're looking too hard at this, trying to fathom some sense of it? And what is really happening is just another attempt to distract from the jobs numbers, the rising prices, and particularly the Epstein files?
Yes. There is that. There's always a look over there, not here element with President Trump. He himself has kind of admitted to that. He loves being a spin doctor. He's done it his entire professional life, even when he was a private citizen in the business world. So I think we just have to continue looking at the data here and using that data to guide those of us interested Americans to logical conclusions. The most important thing here is that Venezuela is not a top cocaine producer. I mean, 84% of the cocaine in the U.S. comes from Colombia. But what Trump does over and over again is uses it as cover for those oil grabs. again, world's largest reserve sit there. So, you know, you've got Trump making the play here, but there's a contradiction. If you're pardoning Honduras' drug lord, ex-president Hernandez, who funneled Venezuelan cocaine, and then you're doing it, President Trump, while bombing boats, it's a hypocrisy that actually boosts Maduro's imperialist narrative.
That's Rina Shah. Thank you so much, Rina. Rina Shah, the political strategist and commentator. Now, we're going to take a short break, and then we will be off to America to talk to Simon Marks, US correspondent. This is LBC.
Coming up at 1 on LBC, James Hansen.
Is this the most dishonest government we've ever had? Could your party be a viable left-wing alternative to Labour? And less than a third of Gen Z men say they're confident changing a light bulb.
James Hansen at 1. Listen on our free Global Player app or our new LBC app.
While all the Whos of Whoville were at McDonald's eating, the Grinch from his lair started plotting and scheming. Gherkin-flavored fries and odd socks will send them crackers. So try the Grinch's new meal and head down to Macca's. Until 4th of Jan from 11 a.m. Price and participation may vary while stocks last. Grinched for adults.
At Lidl, we won't be beaten on price in a range of Christmas mains. Like our Birchwood fresh British whole turkey, smoked gammon joint and more. All at an unbeatable price. Lidl. More to value. Selected products on sale from 27th of the 11th and price match in most major UK supermarkets until 24th of the 12th. See lidl.co.uk/LBTV. While stocks last, exclusions apply.
There's an old Thai saying that roughly translates as, the family who takes the internet on holiday can locate a less crowded beach. Particularly handy, my friends, if it's peak mating season for nippy little crabs. Pack the internet with an eSIM from Airalo. That's A-I-R-A-L-O.
They live in you.
A spectacle far beyond your imagination.
They live in me.
Be amazed. Be moved.
They're watching over.
Be there.
Everything we see.
For an experience that will stay with you forever.
In every creature.
Disney's The Lion King.
In every star.
At London's Lyceum Theatre.
They live in you.
Book now at thelionking.co.uk.
This is LBC with Nick Abbott. Call 0345 6060973. Text 84850. Alexa, send a comment to LBC.
Simon Marks is LBC's Washington correspondent. He is on the line and joins us now. Hello, Simon.
Evening, Nick.
So let's talk first about this Thanksgiving Eve shooting of the National Guardsmen in Washington, D.C. What's the fallout from that?
Well, the fallout from that, Nick, is that President Trump is absolutely doubling down and embracing the opportunity to close America's doors to pretty much all foreigners, apart from white Afrikaner farmers from South Africa, as a result of the fact that the suspect in the shooting that took place less than a third of the mile from the White House on Wednesday afternoon was allegedly carried out by a 29-year-old Afghan immigrant to the United States who had been allowed into the United States originally in September 2021. You'll remember that then President Joe Biden, he just engaged in his completely botched military withdrawal from Afghanistan and was hastily trying to figure out how to allow thousands of Afghans who had put their own lives at risk by assisting U.S. Service personnel during America's longest war in Afghanistan, give them a chance to get out of Afghanistan and not have to take their chances with the Taliban, who, of course, rushed back into power as Joe Biden pulled American forces out. So that is when the suspect arrived in the United States. We learned over the weekend that he was granted asylum here, the right permanently to stay in the United States back in April, very much on Donald Trump's watch. But the President of the United States and his Homeland Security Secretary, Kristi Noem, have spent the weekend trying to deflect questions about why President Trump is blaming Joe Biden for the presence of the suspect on American shores, and indeed for the presence of more than 77,000 other Afghans who assisted U.S. forces during the conflict there. They keep being asked why they don't bear culpability, given that asylum was granted to the alleged shooter back in April. And they insist, well, all the vetting was done by the Biden administration. There's no vetting that is part of the asylum process, which is completely, utterly untrue. In fact, in some interviews today, they've said that Joe Biden allowed these people in with no vetting, which is also flatly untrue. But they're completely trying to deflect all of this onto the former president of the United States, with President Trump now saying that 200,000 Afghans who are on American soil are going to be re-examined, with the possibility of them eventually being rounded up and booted out. Along with immigrants who have become green card holders, permanent legal residents of the United States from 19 separate countries, most of them from the global south, the vast majority of them, of course, from Africa. They too are at risk now of ultimately being rounded up and kicked out by President Trump's thuggish border agent. So he's viewed this shooting as the sort of the perfect political storm, and he's completely doubling down, saying that this just demonstrates how dangerous it was to throw the doors of the United States open to people who were not vetted, even though they were. And he's absolutely doubling down on his new plan, which is to try to secure reverse migration from the United States, shut the doors completely and get as many people out of here as possible.
Yes, he seems to have, as does his the people in his administration, very selective concern about who it is who pulls a trigger in the United States, because, if correct me if I'm wrong, but there's a mass shooting in America at the rate of one every day, and there's a mass shooting in a school in America at the rate of one a week. You know, as far as that's concerned, the call is coming from inside the house.
Yeah, and I think it's worth making the point that last Wednesday's shooting here in Washington, D.C., you know, targeted members of the National Guard, whose presence on Washington's streets was ordered in August by the President of the United States to deal with a purported crime wave, even though the statistics clearly show that violent crime in Washington is at a 30-year low. It is absolutely tragic that a 20-year-old National Guards woman from West Virginia lost her life on Wednesday evening, and that another member of the National Guard, also from West Virginia, is still critically wounded and facing a deeply uncertain prognosis as a result of that shooting. But a federal judge has already ruled that the presence of National Guard troops on the streets of Washington ordered by President Trump is illegal, and he's doubled down and ordered another 500 National Guard to take up positions on the streets of a city that simply doesn't need them here. So he's absolutely grasped this particular incident because it sort of ticks all the boxes for him. The suspect is an Afghan who he says should never have been admitted to the country in the first place, and he can blame Joe Biden for it. The targets were National Guardsmen on the streets, according to President Trump, you know, fighting to overcome a crime wave here in other parts of the country. He wants them to help facilitate the mass deportation program that he's got underway. So this is a shooting about which he wants to act. There are, as you correctly observe, scores of others that don't attract any presidential attention at all, and certainly absolutely no discussion whatsoever, as usual in this country, about the urgent need for gun control and efforts to try and curb the ability of people so easily to get their hands on weapons here.
I mean, that's an interesting detail in this is that if the deployment of the National Guard is illegal, then that sort of comes under this attack, not attack really, but the General Kelly I'm thinking of, he said that, you know, if you are in the military, you don't have to follow illegal orders. And he's been the subject of, you know, Trump's attention ever since. And he's called him a traitor and it's insurrection and all this sort of nonsense. But, I mean, has anything been said about that, that, you know, Trump is now putting more troops on the streets already knowing that doing so is illegal?
Yeah, well, I mean, to be fair to the White House, they are still appealing that ruling. But as you will be aware, they've also lost court cases in other jurisdictions, including Illinois, at a time when they've got National Guard on the streets of Chicago as well. And you're absolutely right to talk about General Mark Kelly and other prominent figures, former military officers who have warned troops that they don't need to obey orders if, for example, the president goes ahead with his threat to invoke the Insurrection Act of 1807 in order to put active troops, active duty troops and Marines on the streets of various cities across the country. You know, he will claim that there is a national security emergency in order to justify any kind of deployment like that. President Trump has accused those men and women of being seditionists for attempting to tell members of the military that they don't need to obey orders, and has even suggested through posts that he's placed, that he's reposted on his social media feed, that they should be tried for treason and potentially even shot. So it's clearly a raw nerve for the President of the United States. But at the end of the day, these legal cases will work their way through the system. It may well be that the Supreme Court ultimately has the final say about these National Guard deployments. And as ever, we will be at that crossroads where we wonder whether the President of the United States is going to obey Supreme Court rulings, or whether the residents of this city, Washington, D.C., and others, just have to get used to the presence of these National Guard troops on the streets. I mean, honestly, doing very little. I mean, the National Guard here has had nothing to do because there's no crime wave to beat back. So, you know, they're out clearing trash off the streets. They're manicuring the parks. I saw several of them last week on the Washington Underground system. They kind of ride the trains looking pretty bored because there isn't much going on the Washington Underground system. And, you know, they patronized the coffee and pastry shops. I mean, that's pretty much life as a National Guardsman on the streets of Washington, D.C. And now we're going to have 500 more of them.
Great. Let's talk about Joe Biden and his use of auto pen.
Hmm. So President Trump has made a whole variety of different presidential sort of statements over the weekend on his social media account. And one of them is that he says that he is terminating, whatever that means, any law that was signed by Joe Biden using the auto pen. In other words, that wasn't personally signed by Joe Biden with pen and ink, but used that machine that presidents have routinely used to sign routine bits of legislation. Now, it is fair to say that Joe Biden's last-minute pardons of members of his family, for instance, were very unusually signed by auto pen in the final hours of the Biden administration. But President Trump, who has mocked President Biden relentlessly for the use of the auto pen, to the point where that there's a series of portraits of every single former president of the United States in the White House West Wing colonnade. That's that outdoor area where you see presidents and their guests, including our own prime minister, walking as they head towards the Oval Office. Well, the portrait there of Joe Biden is actually simply a picture of the auto pen, as President Trump lampoons his predecessor. Now, it's far from clear that Donald Trump has the authority to terminate, whatever that means, laws that were signed by Joe Biden using the auto pen. But theoretically, and perhaps in practical terms, it sounds more like a threat to go after some of those Biden family members that were offered a preemptive pardon, were granted a preemptive pardon by Joe Biden on his final day in office. And given that Donald Trump has already turned the Department of Justice into his office of personal retribution, I think it's going to be interesting to see what kind of investigations Pam Bondi, the Attorney General, is ordered to mount by the president, who, of course, has completely stripped away and eviscerated the Department of Justice's traditional but not constitutionally guaranteed independence here.
Now, there's been some talks about the possibility of peace in Ukraine. How have they gone?
Well, very interesting body language tonight down in Miami. We saw Secretary of State Marco Rubio flanked by U.S. Special Envoy Steve Witkoff and the president's own son-in-law, Jared Kushner, briefing reporters after they spent 4 hours talking to top Ukrainian officials. And Marco Rubio clearly was helming the conversation and clearly was tilting the conversation much more in Ukraine's direction than Steve Witkoff and Jared Kushner would like to have seen it moving. Remember that Steve Witkoff has been completely taken in by the Russians. We now know from a leaked conversation with a top Kremlin aide that Bloomberg News got its hands on that Mr. Witkoff was actively coaching Russian leaders in how to formulate a peace plan that might be appealing to President Trump. We also know that that 28-point peace plan that Mr. Witkoff originally described as President Trump's peace plan was in fact mostly a Russian document that literally, I'm not making this up, Mr. Witkoff or one of his staff members appeared to run through an online translation piece of software, and then they basically tweaked it a bit and stuck a White House crest on the top of it. Marco Rubio clearly is trying to move this process more in Ukraine's favor, and indeed one of the top Ukrainian officials there today said that he had been super supportive of Ukraine's requirements for a lasting peace and also the possibility of future prosperity. But Mr. Witkoff will now be heading back to Moscow for more talks with Vladimir Putin.
Well, let's hope he takes his own translator. Simon, always a pleasure. Thanks so much. Simon Marks, LBC's Washington correspondent. Now, if you missed any of today's show, you can listen back, as with all of our shows, on Global Player or the new LBC app, with which you can read and watch the latest from LBC. You can put your news categories in the order you want. You can pause and rewind live radio and listen to a range of podcasts, a boatload of them on there, including 3 of mine. If you haven't got it, the new LBC app is free. Get it from your app store now. I'll be back Friday, Saturday, Sunday night at 10. Coming up at 4 on LBC, it's Ian Payne. But now, in for Richard Spur, James Hansen.
Thank you, Nick. Good morning. Coming up, new research has found less than a third of Gen Z men feel confident even changing a light bulb. After 3 this morning, how confident are you with DIY and what level of DIY skill should be considered the bare minimum? After 2, the new left-wing party founded by Jeremy Corbyn and Zara Sultana has voted to be named Your Party during a chaotic first conference. Does Britain need a left-wing alternative to Labour? But first up, the Chancellor has been forced to deny allegations that she misled the public and markets ahead of the budget last week. My question to you this hour, is this the most dishonest government we've ever had? 0345 6060 973 is the number. Call me now.
On your radio, on the LBC app, and
Play LBC.
Leading Britain's conversation. This is LBC.
From Global's newsroom at 1 o'clock. The Prime Minister is due to give a speech later saying last week's budget will ensure economic stability after widespread criticism of Rachel Reeves' measures. The Chancellor's been denying claims she misled the country over its finances during the lead-up to her announcements on Wednesday. Jasmine Birtles founded the website Money Magpie. She's been telling LBC she fears extra taxation will be misdirected.
Part of my complaint is what she's going to spend this extra money on. Certainly some is for infrastructure, because if a government is serious about growing the economy and really building up a country, and we need that.
President Trump's Secretary of State is saying Sunday's talks on ending the war in Ukraine have been about securing the country's future. Marco Rubio's been speaking after receiving a delegation from Kyiv in Florida. Police in Northern California say three of the four people who died following a mass shooting there were children. They were at a birthday party in the city of Stockton, around 60 miles from San Francisco. A 24-hour amber weather alert for rain, warning of a possible danger to life in large parts of Wales, has come into force this morning. It's saying the majority of South Wales could experience deep flood waters. The forecaster John Ketley has been talking to LBC.
The rivers will get more and more swollen. It's always going to be worse probably over western parts of the UK. The weather's coming at us from the west.